This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Well, let's see what's out there. Who among you has ever looked up at the night sky and wondered what is beyond those stars? A gentleman who not only has shared your wonder, but has done a great deal to explore that question and explain some of the potential answers to that question on radio and on TV and to me, quite frankly, is one of my very favorite guests, not only because he's full of knowledge, but because he has the best voice in all of radio, the one and only Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, a veteran radio and TV broadcaster and edutainer who has a great deal of expertise in astronomy and space, and he's one of my favorite people to talk to, and it's a real treat whenever we get to spend an hour together, as is the case this morning. Steve, it is great to talk with you. Thank you again for joining me on the radio.
Frank, it's a high honor. Thank you so much for your compliments, and a good morning to you and the listeners.
Well, Steve, before we get into what's happening in space, and obviously there's certainly a great deal happening in space, I'm wondering, do you have any insight into this weird weather that we're experiencing? Yesterday in New York, we had all these horrible thunderstorms. There are still flash flood warnings all over the place. Today, they say we may even get some thunderstorms. Tropical storm Elsa is appearing to hit us. Any insight into what the story is with all this weather we're experiencing?
Well, Frank, so much of the world believes, obviously, in climate change, and I'm certainly not a denier, but I want to look into this deeper. So the simple thing I would respond here to you is this. All weather is controlled by the sun. This particular solar cycle, as was the last one, as it ended, was a little strange unto itself. So if you extrapolate the changes that happened with solar cycle 24, meaning a long period of no sunspots on the sun, and now, just about a week or so ago, I think it may be even this week, the first X flare has appeared in the solar cycle 25. So something is really askew out there. But if you ask other those people in the meteorological world, they're going to say that a lot of these weather systems seemingly are changing. I need not remind you and the listeners here in Phoenix today, 113 degrees. Over the weekend, the humidity starts to kick in as we have this monsoon. But strange patterns, not to give any specificity, Frank, on this one. Nobody really knows for sure what's happening. But from the climate change side, for those, of course, that are diehards in this, there is something that's really changing with our weather. But I'd say let's go back and study the cycles of the sun. And let's just see what that does, because all weather, once again, is dependent on the sun.
Mm. And, you know, to make this a little bit selfish, I'm supposed to go down to the Jersey Shore this weekend on Friday.
No.
Is a tropical storm Elsa going to disrupt any of my plans in driving down to Atlantic City on Friday?
Well, too early to say, but knowing you and the listeners that would want the most peaceful beach experience, I'm hoping that that sucker moves off the coast. It'll probably refire as a hurricane, as they're saying, but it needs to get over warm water to do that.
You and me both, we share that hope. All right. Now, the big story, I think this is the biggest story in the country and perhaps on the planet right now. That is the space race between Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. And I've been a little surprised that there hasn't been greater media attention paid to this throughout the National Press Corps, because I think it's a pretty big story. For people that haven't followed the story and don't know exactly what's happening,
sure,
what are Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson doing with respect to space?
Well, great question. Both are looking to privatize space. Branson's been doing this a lot longer than Bezos, and to go back in the time tunnel, they have a facility in New Mexico, north of where I went to school at New Mexico State, just north of Las Cruces, that's been sitting there pretty idle for so many years. And so many people in the New Mexico legislature were saying they'll never fly, they'll never get going. But it's a long road to the stars. And this is what Branson has basically been doing over the longest period of time. Many people may not know this. Back in 2004, I had the honor of interviewing a gentleman named Mike Melville. Who's he? He's the first commercial astronaut in space. He was one of the early pioneers to bring the Virgin Galactic space plane up to that altitude. Because remember, in order to get to space, there's many theories on this as to the exact height. They call it the Kármán line. Let's say 50 plus miles. I'm going to say more specifically about 60 miles above the Earth. If you can sustain that moment in time, you know, through all the G-forces, you would be weightless for a period of time. So Mike Melville and other astronauts, or as we say, spacefarers, have gone up there. One of the first videos that they did, they took a whole bunch of these little peanut M&Ms and threw them around the cabin, and you bet weightlessness is there, and all these little M&Ms are floating around in there. But the long road to the stars, as we talk about Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic has had a few major, major upsets. Their first spacecraft that they had that was actually something which was space-worthy, at least in the testing, was Virgin spaceship called Enterprise. Many people may not remember it was actually destroyed, and they had loss of life in October of 2014. But they, teaming up, of course, with Burt Rutan, one of the great engineering and great amazing designers of aviation aircraft and spacecraft, they put together the next of the iterations, a little more advanced. It's called the VSS, the Virgin Spaceship Unity. And that's the one that's going to make the attempt to go up into space. But this is the different side of what's happening with Frank. I mean, of what's going on with Richard Branson, Frank. His is a space plane that is literally dropped from a mothership. And what's so interesting about this, Virgin Mothership Eve, named after Richard Branson's mother, is this amazing, out of this world, you'll have to Google it, folks, this amazing otherworldly spaceship, like two fuselages connected together with a separation. And what they do is they attach this little spacecraft, the Unity, underneath it. So let's say we get on it. Pilots are flying the mothership. They take us upwards to 40 or 50,000 feet. And lo and behold, we're dropped. Now, this goes back to a lot of history about the B-52. And remember the X-15 space planes that were flown? The same thing, Frank, was done back in the late 50s with even Neil Armstrong. They took this mothership, a B-52, and underneath one of the wings, they dropped the X-15 rocket plane. So this is a modern iteration. I mean, really high tech in those days. You know, and I've interviewed so many of these astronauts that flew, like Pete Knight, who flew well over about, I think he was like Mach 6 during the late 1960s, one of the fastest flights ever. So if you went on board this, the Branson spacecraft, the space plane, to me, it's a much more, this is just my opinion, it's a much more comfortable ride because you're sitting in a little spacecraft that has wings on it. But Frank, can you imagine the kick in the pants once you're dropped? Because those rocket engines kick in and you're doing a similar kind of rise to altitude like these X-15s did in the past. It's literally a kick in the pants because you're going to get up to a speed of Mach 3. And then what's going to happen? It's going to reach upwards of 300 and some odd thousand feet or go up to 50, 60 miles. And you're going to have the moments up there, maybe 5 minutes or so, I'm not sure the exact time, of the weightlessness experience where you're going to float around the cabin. And then what's going to happen is the wing plane on this is going to articulate up to about 65 degrees, and it's going to do a controlled descent back through the atmosphere, and it's going to land on a runway like an airplane would. So that's what Richard Branson and his crew are going to be doing.
Just to be clear, Dominic Carter on the program that precedes this one, mm-hmm. when I was promoting this segment and talking about this story, he and I was talking about the Branson and Bezos space race. Dominic asked me, are both Sir Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos going to space themselves? My understanding is that with this Virgin flight, which at this point is scheduled for July 11th, just a few days from now, Branson is planning to be on board that plane.
He absolutely is. And there's chief pilot and chief engineers and chief of the directorate of, you know, all the astronaut training are all going to be on here. And I wish them well, because for Richard Branson, you know, my heart goes out to him because he's had some setbacks. They've had a few, you know, they have had some loss of life on this. They've had kind of the sticky effect, as I call it, where the media has been, you know, real sticky with him saying, you know, when are you ever going to do this? You know, it's going to take so long, but you should only fly when you're ready, obviously. Nobody should push anybody to do this. That's obvious. But he's involved in other efforts, too. Just know this. They have another developmental project, which actually they've been testing, called Launcher One. And what's that? You can actually launch small payloads from the underwing of this most phenomenal 747 called Cosmic Girl for rocket payloads. So that's another way to get small payloads into space. But this is strictly, from the Branson side, a space tourism type of a project. So I wish him well. I mean, this is something very interesting. But on the Bezos side, we've heard all stories where people had what, a petition, Frank, saying, please don't come back. I mean, how nasty is that?
Well, you know, you can't, unfortunately, those of us that are in the public eye, and you and I are in it, one millionth to the level that somebody like Jeff Bezos is. You have a bunch of wise guys that always say stuff like that. So that's not entirely surprising. But I do give both of these guys an enormous amount of credit, Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, because not only are they billionaires who could sit on a tropical island somewhere drinks from coconut-shaped cups, but they're investing an enormous amount of their own money to further the cause of space exploration, and they're actually being willing to do something that's pretty risky and go to space themselves.
You know something, this is interesting, and if we have time, I wanted to shift gears and talk about Jeff Bezos and, of course, his project, Blue Origin, with the new Shepard program. His is a little different. His is kind of like a, I don't know, more like a SpaceX-ish kind of concept. You have a booster rocket, and you have the new Glenn. Obviously, you have the little new Shepard on top of it, I should say, in which people get inside this little capsule that sits on top of the rocket. So it, too, launches and goes up to about, you know, Mach 3 speed. Wow, imagine that ride. Then the capsule separates from the booster. The astronauts are going to unbuckle. You get some weightlessness opportunity there. So this little tiny capsule is just floating back up into space, reaching this apogee point. I'm making it sound simple. The booster reentry is doing something like a Falcon 9, like a SpaceX. It's going to soft land about a two-mile distance from the launch pad because you don't want it to collide with the launcher, I mean the descent module. But there, you reach the apogee, and the astronauts are going to feel weightlessness for a while and get the view, and they're going to rebuckle in, and then you'll start to feel this incredible velocity again, you know, the G-forces, and then parachutes, as all goes well, we pray, will return them to a slow speed of about 16 miles an hour, and you'll go thump like the Russians do. Remember, the Russians don't land in the water in their space missions. They land on land, which entirely is bizarre if you think about it, because there's no cushioning effect for the water, but hopefully in this case, you'll be able to do this. But there's even more of an interesting thing, Frank, going on the Bezos mission. One of the most amazing women who was originally part of the Mercury 13 training, an unofficial program that NASA had other than the, you know, Mercury 7, as we all know about the men who did that, there was this Loveless Clinic program where the women actually tested to go to space. And one woman with this unusual name, Wally Funk. She's now 82 years old. God bless her. Bezos has decided to have her go on. Her lifelong dream was to go to space. She tried, Frank, three times to get into the space program, to be an official astronaut all through her life. They rejected her because she didn't have an engineering degree and didn't have test flight experience. So I'm really happy for
her. Me too.
Imagine that feeling.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
That is tremendous. So you have the Richard Branson space flight, which is scheduled for July 8th. You have the Jeff Bezos space flight, which is scheduled for July 20th. It certainly is a pretty exciting time to be paying attention to this stuff. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Steve Cates. He's an edutainer. He's a TV and radio commentator on issues related to astronomy, issues related to space. If you want to call in with questions, Steve will take them. Heaven knows I'm in no position to answer them. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. And we'll be happy to take your questions throughout the hour. When we come back, I want to ask you, sure, Steve, a little bit about the comparisons between this new private sector space race and what we saw between different governments in the 1950s and 60s, Russia and the U.S. space race, because I think there are some interesting similarities and some very interesting differences. We will take your calls, 800-848-9222. But one of the questions, whenever I see astronauts in a documentary or talking to kids in a school, one of the questions that I always see astronauts need to answer is questions about their own human waste. Now, that leads me to a discussion about how you can make sure what you are doing in terms of your own personal filtration is for the best. And that's why I really want to talk to you about GetTheTea.com. If you go to the website GetTheTea.com, they sell this detox tea on there. It's called Life Change Tea. It's an all herbal formula. It's a powerful herbal formula that will give you more energy without caffeine, and it will keep you regular, whether you're an astronaut, whether you're an aspiring astronaut, or whether you're just somebody that wants to filter out all these toxins that we're all exposed to, maybe because of drinking booze, maybe because of the preservatives that are in our food, maybe because of the environmental factors that we're dealing with on a regular basis. Life Change Tea can help. So all you have to do is go to the website, GetTheTea.com. You can buy some of this Life Change Tea on there. It's all natural. There's no fillers. It's completely organic. It's GetTheTea.com. And if you order some and you use the promo code Frank, you'll actually get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC. The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. This is an exciting time to be alive because we are on the precipice of a whole bunch of groundbreaking discoveries made possible due to the technological age in which we're living in. And nowhere is that more exciting to watch than what's happening in space. So we have one of my favorite experts when it comes to space and astronomy with us for the hour. We are going to take your phone calls at 800-848-9222 as I'm joined by Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is a radio and TV broadcaster, as if you couldn't tell by that great set of pipes that he has. And he has a great deal of expertise in the fields that I just mentioned. Steve, if people want to hear you regularly when you're not with me, when you're not with John Catsimatidis on his Sunday show, sure, how can they hear you? What's the best way for them to do that?
Simply go to KTAR.com. That's our radio station flagship there in Phoenix, Arizona, among other stations. But there, if you go ahead and click onto the menu section, go to the podcast, you can actually hear the full half-hour pre-recorded shows that we do. People tell us that they like it. We've been doing that for 10 years, and there's also our new podcast in there. And, of course, my email is drskyshow@gmail.com. More than happy to answer questions that the listeners have if they can't get in the time allotted.
All right. 800-848-9222. Mark is in Newark. Mark, what's your question for Dr. Sky?
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. Doctor, during the Big Bang, the temperature was very high, more than 20,000 degrees Celsius, I think. How come all this methane, oil, all this stuff did not burn? Why they are still here?
What we're talking about, sir, is when the universe was theoretically created, as you said, 13.5 billion years ago, there was this large temperature explosion that happened probably around 380 million years into the existence of the universe. But at that time, we didn't have the Earth or anything like that. The universe sustained itself and then later cooled off in a great cooling period that literally took almost a billion or more years just to coalesce into planets and objects. So all those things like oil and everything, that was an afterthought. It wasn't even around at the time when this happened. But there's still this remnant that we see, Mark, in the universe. If you look out into deep space, there's kind of like the burn marks, and it's a little too simple to say burn. The remnants of that explosion are still visible, called the cosmic microwave background radiation in space.
Well,
thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
Steve, we were talking about the the space race with Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos. Richard Branson going to space on July 11th. Jeff Bezos going to space on July 20th. Both sort of different missions, which maybe we'll delve into a little bit more. But we did not yet really mention too much about the other spacefaring billionaire that our listeners may have heard a great deal about, and that's Elon Musk and his program of SpaceX. What is SpaceX up to right now? And are these other billionaires just embarrassing Elon Musk by leaving him on Earth?
No, you added, I think, in my opinion, I mean, if I rate them all, they're all good. But Elon's done something. It's almost like you have to categorize him as what? A genius in his own way. I mean, we just purchased a Tesla ourselves. I'm so happy with it. I was kind of like, who knows about this technology? But the point is, I've realized that these things really are amazing. It's almost like having a spaceship. But what's he up to right now? This is the interesting part. He's been repeatedly the launches of the Starlink satellites, controversial as they are. The astronomy community, Frank, is kind of up in arms that they're kind of populating every square inch of space. Not exactly that, but I've used a little bit of liberty here to say it and exaggerate, that when they're taking pictures with these giant telescopes, which are nothing more than super digital cameras, and let's say you and I are doing that and we press a button and we say, look at this galaxy, and guess what we're seeing around the galaxy? Too many smears and lines cutting across our images. But we know what that project is about. It's to give internet to the world, which is a great thing. But his latest project, where there's a big phase shift now, is looking at Starship. They've had repetitive failures down at Boca Chica, down in southern Texas, where they're launching this amazing 1950s-looking surreal little spacecraft that's supposed to be the mothership to the journeys to the moon and to Mars. But now they're going to stack it on top of this supermassive rocket. And I wouldn't be surprised if we get to see that whole stack. I don't know. It's probably going to be the tallest rocket in the world. 400 feet, allegedly. That's bigger than the Saturn V, which was 365 feet tall by a bit. And it will be one of these that's going to launch soon, bigger and heavier than the Falcon Heavy. I can't imagine how this guy can keep up with all this stuff, Frank. Can you? It's like every day they're doing something incredible. But his goal is to be on Mars, go to Mars, make that journey, and I'm sure, I don't doubt this guy, I think he's going to do it.
So I alluded to the space race that took place in the 50s and 60s mm-hmm. between Russia and the United States, Sputnik and the Apollo program. It seemed to me that, look, obviously you always want countries working together, but it seemed to me that the net effect of both the United States and Russia being so eager to show their global superiority in the space game was that it led to a faster movement forward for spacefaring technology. Do you see that happening now with the private sector space race? And in general, how do you see this private sector space race comparing to what we saw 60 years ago?
Well, I think it's doing the 100-yard dash like in record time compared to somebody who's walking the distance. And again, not to knock the government here in this regard, but let's be realistic. All of the fights that they've had to get people to space when NASA did this and the Russians did this. Remember, back on April 12th of 1961, Yuri Gagarin was the first human to go into space. He didn't just go up into space like we're talking about Bezos's flight to go up and then come down. He actually orbited the Earth, followed by Alan Shepard and Freedom 7, May 5th, 1961. So this race was on, but it's all about politics. I mean, I've been reading, you know, so much the backstory. We do other interviews with other, you know, authors in the space program. And to answer you completely, it would take an hour. But the short version of this, Frank, is very interesting, I find. There were times when even President Nixon, who signed off on the space shuttle, had an opportunity in which to sign off on these nuclear rockets that were developed called the NERVA project, which we could have made these journeys to places like Mars, could have been much farther out into the universe. And this is my opinion, you're asking me. I think we kind of tripped when we got kind of a little complacent. The space shuttle was a great program. We lost lives on it, sad to say. But unfortunately, that should have happened a long time before that, and we should have looked at a quicker and easier way to get to space. Now, a lot of people may take exception with me and say, hey, wait a minute, Dr. Sky, that space shuttle boosted the Hubble Space Telescope. It boosted so many other things into orbit. A great concept. What was it? A heavy glider. But it's always politics and money. That's exactly what it is. But look at these guys now. They're money rich in their whole orbits in what they're doing. None of these people are dying on the vine financially. What happened to Bezos the other day? Allegedly what? The richest man in the world with a fortune of what? $211 billion? Can you imagine what the interest goes on if you went to sleep one night? I mean, wouldn't that be literally astronomical?
It would indeed. A bunch of people queued up to talk with you, Steve.
Oh, yes.
But
let me
ask you one last question
before
we move on with Branson and this private sector space race.
Yes,
so you alluded to some of the difficulties that the Virgin Galactic space program has had. And, of course, there was an accident with a Virgin Galactic test flight back in 2014 that left one pilot dead.
Yes.
You talked about the media pressure, everybody kind of saying to Richard Branson, oh, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. Why aren't you guys making more progress? I'm wondering, how much pressure was there to stop after that pilot died back in 2014?
I can only imagine. I mean, I don't know the backstory on this, but I'm sure the FAA was involved. It's a horrible thing when you have the National Transportation Safety Board on site, like any craft, I mean, any aircraft crash. But you're so right. The pressure was so much. I'm sure they wanted to fold the entire thing. And remember, there's a lot of people, not to knock them, that have the $250,000 that were then maybe thinking of bailing because now we had an incident. I'm not going to fly it. Frank, you're not going to fly it if we think it's not safe. So the point is, this money that's sitting in escrow and holding, you know, holding in a bank somewhere, the whole thing came very, very close, I'm sure, to seeing a finality of this whole thing. And even the state of New Mexico, if you look at this, you read into some of the backstory of New Mexico. They were so concerned because monies were coming to them and they were promising that they'll be building this, you know, spaceport, and nothing happened for so long. So I really give him a lot of credit for hanging in there. And I don't know. I mean, Frank, seriously, I'll ask you a question. Would you actually fly on your spacecraft knowing the things you know? And, you know, it's just a simple yes or no. But would you actually do this? Look at all you'd have to risk. If something would happen to you, your whole business is going to go down the drain.
Right. Well, I think the answer is yes. And actually, I had that on my list of questions for you as well this hour. So I'd be curious about your answer to that as well.
Sure. Well, I think, honestly, Frank, simply very quickly, I would do it. But I got a better idea. Why don't we both petition to be the two journalists that go to space? And if we can't go on the same mission, you cover one and I'll cover the other.
Sounds good to me. 800-848-9222. We'll get to everybody that's on hold. If you have questions for Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, now's the time. 1-800-848-WABC. Corey is in Hollywood, Florida. Hello, Corey.
Hey, Frank. You know, I love you.
Thank you.
It's an honor speak to Dr. Sky. So being a private sector funded program versus a federally funded program, but well regulated by NASA, what do you do? My opinion is that we can do that five times cheaper and five times quicker without the regulation financially of the federal government.
So I guess the question, Steve, is about private sector space travel versus public sector space travel.
Well, let me say this.
Right.
I'm like Corey. I think it's great. If you can do this safely and have less red tape in it and then prosper and, you know, send people to space, and it's actually making money for a company, which they have every right to do, Corey, I think I'm in favor of that, just like you're describing here. Less regulation, but not safety regulations. In other words, there's a lot of paperwork.
Right.
And some of the things, Corey, were even stopped. I mean, there were a few violations that the FAA came across with their launches down in Texas, and they had a few bumps in the road. Somebody's got to regulate it. But obviously the simple answer from me is less regulation to make the red tape less difficult. But let's still do it in a safe manner.
Thank you, Corey. 800-848-WABC. Joe is in Jamaica. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Frank. Nice hearing from both of you guys.
Thank you.
Quick
question.
Hey, I was born in Jamaica. I was born there too, my friend.
Oh, well, I'm in Jamaica, New York.
That's where I was born.
Oh, okay. Quick question. Back in before John Kennedy was assassinated, here's the challenge to NASA about putting a man on the moon before the end of the decade. Yes. Now that we're in the 2000s, you know, and so forth, has anyone put a challenge before NASA to do something else, like, you know, put a man on Mars or something, or
on Mars? Joe, right. It's interesting that you bring this up. I think, and I'm always honest here with everybody, I'm pretty confident that there was a press conference when President Bush, number two, you know, Bush second, was in office, where they actually made a declaration saying that our goal should be focused at NASA to get a human on the surface of Mars. And I also think they were talking about a return to the moon. But unfortunately, like the mother's milk of what? Politics is money, and the whole thing in the space program, the government side, is money. Obviously, that never seemed to have a focused point. It could have a long time ago, but like I said, I'm repeating myself, even during the Nixon administration, they could have supported the development of these nuclear rockets, and we could have actually been farther out in the solar system a long time ago. But I think money was the issue, and it never
got to
that.
What is NASA up to right now? I know we've heard a lot about this Mars rover. Oh, yeah. What's the status of that? And there seems to be efforts from countries like China and the UAE to also explore Mars. Where are we with Mars exploration specifically, and what is NASA doing specifically?
Well, let me give Jim Bridenstine, the previous administrator of NASA, a lot of credit. I remember him as a congressman, and we had him on our programs talking about what his evolution for space would be, and it sure came about. So their focus right now, okay, with the new administrator into NASA, is that they're looking to go to the moon. It's a project called Artemis, and I think this is also a great project. This is a project to send not only men to the surface of the moon, but your first female astronauts, and there's a bunch of them. I'm trying to get a few interviews with some of these candidates. There's like 10 of them, and who knows? We'll just roll the dice, and maybe we'll be lucky and get the one who's the first female on the moon, but that's a joint effort. They're looking to build an orbital platform around the moon that will be quite interesting, like a small space station, so that we have a way to go up and down to the moon and not have to worry about, you know, resupply from the Earth like the Apollo missions. It's a one-way deal with whatever you can carry, food and water. That's going to happen. And they're also looking to develop base stations on the surface of the moon. And this is also an interesting project, probably at the very south pole of the moon, in an area that an L-Cross spacecraft was slammed into the surface of the moon a long, long time ago. I remember the night we were out with our telescopes trying to see if we could see the flash. We did not. The reason they're sending it there, they know in some of these craters called Shackleton at the very south pole of the moon, the sun doesn't rise but on the top of the mountain ranges. So you could put solar panels there, have this quiet area because you don't want to go into the full light of the sun. It's too hot. And you could eventually develop a base station, as we say, a lunar base on the moon. But, Frank, this is really bizarre. Of all the places measured in the solar system, people would say, well, where's the coldest place? And I would think, you know, common sense, way out there by the little dwarf Pluto. Get a load of this. The coldest temperature measured in the solar system is at the southern pole of the moon. And not to be precise here at this early hour, to be an exact person, but I'm honest, I think we're looking at about some 300 and something degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So NASA's program is to go back to the moon. I don't know how focused they are on the Mars mission, but I think they're going to have a little problem with their space station. I mean, not space station, their rocket. They have a heavy rocket that they want to launch, but I think, in my opinion, Elon has done so much in the way of being advanced there that I think they're way behind the curve on their rocket.
Interesting. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Chris in Brooklyn. Chris, you're on with Dr. Sky.
Yeah, Frank. Good show as usual.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris.
Yes. How are you, Sky?
Doing well.
I'm wondering if you, I guess you should remember, because you just mentioned a few minutes ago, as a young fellow myself, going back years ago,
yes,
that Challenger, when it blew up and
yes,
killed these three astronauts, I believe. What was ever the cause of it, you know? Very shabby with the work and whatnot, from what I understand.
Yes. The sad answer is that the O-rings that were on these solid mm-hmm. rocket motors, remember, the shuttle itself mm-hmm. had an engine that used the propellant from the large tank, that big tank that it was strapped to. What happened is the mm-hmm. solid rocket motors, those two things are like taking, if you ever look at a crayon, I mean, like an eraser. The fuel was like that of an eraser, like a reddish solid material. What happened is the O-rings that were on there, part of the rocket system, were very weak, and I'm being very basic here. They shouldn't have launched that particular spacecraft because of the temperatures. That metal just flexed so badly that in that particular day when they did launch, obviously with the first teacher on board and many other souls, that particular rocket got up into a very low altitude, and I think, and I'm going back in time tunnel here, back in 1968, about 73 seconds, that particular flame burned through the solid rocket motor O-ring, and the flame, residual flame, burned through the big external tank, and then you had the explosion. But sadly, gentlemen, Frank and Chris, it's now been reported that those astronauts on board probably survived into the crash, into the ocean, and were not summarily blown apart in the air. That's horrible.
Boy. And just to, for the sake of clarity, 1986, not 1968.
1986, correct.
Right. And, you know, I've always been amazed and impressed from the first time I heard you on the radio, Steve, at your breadth of knowledge on this subject. And I know you're not actually a doctor, not a PhD when it comes to astronomy or anything like this. How did you acquire such an incredible, vast array of knowledge about all this stuff? What is your educational background for people that are wondering?
Well, from college, here we go. This is very interesting. From college, journalism has been my thing. And ever since I was small, I had great parents. Of course, they've passed on to the infinite. But we lived in Jackson Heights, Queens. You lived in one of these big apartment buildings. And I'll never forget it. When I was a young boy, they decided to get this telescope for me because I always had the passion to want to look into the sky. And what they did was they took me up to the top of the apartment building, and I was hooked. And then I started to do so many things, you know, going into regular school but into college, both there in New Jersey and then going out to New Mexico State, you know, studying this subject as I wanted to, but more in the sense of the journalism side. I've always done shows. I came from the television world back in New York, not to bore you with my background, but it was always something that I said, you know, here's something I'd really love to do as a passion, and that is share with the world, as we talk about Dr. Sky as a corporation, we talk about this from this particular standpoint. What's the main theme of our whole radio and television and company? To entertain and educate the world on all that's in the sky. A simple mission, and I'm glad you like it, and I'm hoping that the listeners do, too.
All right. We're going to continue with Dr. Sky in just a minute. 800-848-9222 if you have questions. It's 800-848-WABC. Whether you're a broadcaster or an astronaut, whether you work in the private sector or the public sector, there are all sorts of instances in which you might find yourself getting hurt at work. If you do get hurt at work, and you want to go through the workers' compensation process, if you don't have a responsible law firm behind you, if you don't have a law firm that knows the workers' compensation process inside and out, your head will spin because of the complexity in the workers' comp process. That's why you need to turn to the law firm of Angiulli and Gentili. If you've been hurt at work, or if you have an occupational disease that's turned your life upside down, these guys, Angiulli and Gentili, have been helping people like you for over 35 years. I know these folks. They're good people, great lawyers, and they'll listen to your concerns. They'll explain how this whole process works. They'll get you the medical treatment and the workers' compensation payments you're entitled to. The lawyers at Angiulli and Gentili have handled thousands of hearings and will help you walk with confidence. Call Angiulli and Gentili today at 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-COMP, as in workers' comp. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. 888-234-COMP, 888-234-2667. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. I want to remind you that Music Radio 77 WABC is adding more music to your weekend. Proud to welcome two-time Tony nominee and American Idol finalist Constantine Morales to WABC. That's going to be Saturdays at 5 o'clock because Saturdays rock here on WABC. There's great music, great conversation, and the biggest names in the business. Now, after he's on, you'll still get to hear the legendary Cousin Brucey at 6. Then at 10, it's iconic entertainer Tony Orlando, and his special guest this week is Mickey Gilley from Memphis to Nashville. Spend your Saturday night with Tony Orlando and 77 WABC. In the meantime, we're spending the hour with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. If you want to hear more that we don't get to, we haven't even scratched the surface of the number of subjects that I was hoping to get to in the course of this hour, which means, Steve, you're just going to have to come back soon.
Well, thank you. You
have to go to ktar.com, and
yes,
you could check out some of Steve's podcasts on a wide variety of subjects. We're going to take as many of your calls as we can, 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Marvin in Spring Valley. Hello, Marvin.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Hey, Steve, I just want to say greetings from
Paladin Nation. You make us all proud.
Wow, that's going back in the time tunnel, my friend. And what you're referring to, so many people don't know, our days at Paramus Catholic High School. There you go.
When you were a star in track.
Well, you're being very kind. And right now, Frank, I don't know if Frank knows this, but it's very nice to reminisce about this. But those legs have gotten hurt. I'm suffering here in my own way, Frank, as you know, and Marvin, with total right knee replacement, and I'm a big baby. It hurts like hell.
You're tougher than you give yourself credit for. Thank you, Marvin.
You make us all proud.
Hey, thank you, my friend.
That's
appreciate
for sure. 800-848-WABC. Let me ask you this before we continue with the calls. You know, I alluded to China taking a more active role in terms of space exploration. Why do you think that is? China has generally tended to be pretty focused on what's happening in Asia. Now they seem focused on getting involved with what's happening around the globe and even in outer space, including these Mars missions. What brought about this change in China's attitude towards space exploration?
Well, I think President Xi is responsible for this, because if you look at China, not to get too political here, whatever people's opinions are, it seems like they're trying to be everywhere all the time. But let's talk space for a minute. This is an amazing accomplishment. When they had the Tianwen-1, which is their orbiter, that, of course, has a spacecraft that goes down, has an orbiter first. They did all three of these things in one time, which took America an all-time, long time to do this. They had an orbiter going around Mars. They had a lander. And then they had the Zhurong spacecraft, which is now sitting on the surface of Mars. That's incredible, just in the short time. But I think now they're looking to just be everywhere. And I think from the military side, I think we better pay attention to that, because let's hope they don't take the next battleground into space. But, Frank, I just wanted to interject something here that for everybody listening, this is something quite fascinating, really quick. You can see these following visual man-made satellites, and I just pick on the Tianhe-1. This is their new space station in orbit. The time, July the 8th, tonight, 10:35 p.m., it'll be coming out of the eastern part of the sky to nearly overhead at 10:35 p.m. You'll see it go by. They got three Tikhonauts or astronauts on board. Then if you miss that, July the 10th at 10:10 p.m., east to southeast, you'll see it, an incredibly bright object moving in the sky. And then we have the International Space Station on July the 12th, as bright as the planet Venus at 10:19 p.m., moving out of the southwest to the northeast. And if you miss that one, oh my gosh, you get another one on July the 13th at, get a load of for early risers, 4:49 a.m., as this object nearly passes overhead at 4:51 in the morning in 30 seconds. How about that?
That's perfect for our audience.
Bright as the planet Venus. So isn't that amazing? You can see all this stuff from even the largest brilliantly lit cities in the world. As we talk about Phoenix being the fifth largest city in America, you can still see these things. But the Tianhe, going back to China, this thing's about the size of a tractor trailer. And they got three guys in there with some special food that they're cooking. And they took a spacewalk, and they're trying to put the next pieces together. They're going to build a fairly large space station.
Wow.
Go
wow.
Figure.
800-848-WABC. Nick is here in Manhattan. Hello, Nick.
Nikki?
Oh, I thought it – well, my board says Nick, but I'll take,
well, you
I'll
can
take
call
your
me
word
Nick.
For it if it's Mickey.
Hi, Frank. Hi, Dr. Sky. I was
Good
just
morning.
Curious if there's any indication that all this space activity with the humans and the machines and the equipment, if it affects the weather.
You know, I don't know that. That's a very interesting thing, because what are we doing, Nikki? We're populating space with more stuff, some of it junk. You know, we're obscuring some of the sunlight that naturally comes down to the Earth here. But I don't really know. I mean, my answer to you is, again, I'm really not sure how that has a direct effect, if any. But remember, 100 years ago, we didn't have this problem. So maybe you're onto something there. We'll have to check that out.
That's a great question. I've not thought about that, but it is certainly food for thought. We're going to continue with your calls in just a moment. 800-848-WABC. But it maybe you have chronic knee injuries or chronic knee pain, as Steve Cates did, but you're not yet ready to go the surgery route. Maybe you're not yet ready to have your knees replaced. What are you supposed to do? Well, you can't just sit there in agony. What if you have chronic knee pain or chronic back pain or shoulder tendonitis or plantar fasciitis or tennis elbow? Well, Trinity Rehab has got a solution for you. These folks will restore your freedom to live pain-free. It's not your father's physical therapy. This is cutting-edge, state-of-the-art stuff. They have something called the EPAP machine. This is an FDA-approved, non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing, gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back pain, neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, all sorts of other chronic pain situations. There isn't any prescription needed to get started. They're all over the state of New Jersey. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and a brand new location in Woodbridge, New Jersey. So if you're suffering in pain, before you turn to prescription pain medication, before you turn to surgery, call Trinity Rehab. 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky,
flash, flash, how it goes down.
Wonderful you came by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, when out of that orange-colored view,
flash, flash, how it goes down.
I gotta look at you.
The great Nat King Cole singing Orange Colored Sky, where we're talking with Dr. Sky, better known as Steve Cates. He is an edutainer. He is somebody with a great passion for astronomy and space. He's a veteran radio and TV broadcaster, not just with respect to space, but all sorts of things he's able to talk about. But we're taking advantage of his space expertise today. 800-848-WABC, answering your questions. Tyrone is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Tyrone.
Yes, Frank. I missed the show when Dr. Sky was there the last time. Did he ever talk about those things in space moving five times the speed of light?
You know, I think we did talk about that last time. There was something in the physics world that I think is not a really an official thing. It's not confirmed. But something, at least from the world of quantum physics, is something called this amazing particles called tachyons. And they haven't been proven, but it's, well, how can you say that they're real then? But that would be something that theoretically has capabilities of going faster than the speed of light. But unfortunately, Tyrone and Frank, we haven't had any real closure on that one yet. That's just way out there in the theoretical side.
Thank you, Tyrone. 800-848-WABC. Tom is in Boston. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Frank. How you doing?
Hey,
I just want to say China is way back. They're way back behind us. They stole all the technology from us. And I tell you, there's one thing I want to let you know.
Yes, sir.
Back in the 90s, back in the 1990s, China did not have the technology for ballistic missiles. So yeah. they went over to Bill Clinton, and they said, we don't have the technology to put satellites in space. So he sent Loral, I think it was Loral or LaSalle, and he knew the CEO, and they taught China to multiple-stage rocket building. And lo and behold,
yes,
a year later, they had every city in the United States targeted.
All right,
so
Tom.
It doesn't sound
like much of a question there, Tom.
Well,
but
Tom's onto it. Right, he's onto it, Frank, but I wanted to add something else. There was a Chinese scientist, and forgive me for not remembering his name right now, who studied at JPL in California. And I believe this was like in the 1950s and 60s. What happened was he was deported, and allegedly most of the rocket science that China got was from this individual who moved, of course, or was forced to move out of the United States, deported is the word, and they got a lot of their technology as far as building space and other military devices. And the similar backstory is, of course, how they acquired nuclear weapons, and I need not remind the listeners that also Russia involved in a lot of the spying things with so many people in the 50s. But, you know, it's a very interesting story. But Tom is actually right, though. There was something during the Clinton administration where a lot of this technology seeped out. I don't know how, and I'm not saying that's a good thing.
Wow. 800-848-WABC. Let me squeeze in at least one more call here. Tom in Tom's River has been waiting patiently. Hello, Tom.
Awesome. I'm glad I'm the last one. So how are you, Frank, and how are you, Steve? I've spoken to both of you before.
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing well here in Phoenix, suffering at this hour of the night here with a temperature of 100 degrees still at almost 11 o'clock my time. There you go.
Well, go ahead and take a cold shower.
I think I need one, my friend. Absolutely.
All right. So I want to know, you know, I've heard you mention God, G-O-D. I've heard you mention the word pray, and I've heard you mention the word soul in the conversation tonight. I want to ask a personal question. Do you, with all your education, I want to know your analysis. Do you believe in God?
Oh, absolutely. I was, you know, raised a Catholic, but that doesn't make me believe in God. I believe in this. I believe a God created this universe. I believe in many cases that even our physics today is nowhere in comprehension to what the God figure is, whether it's a man with a beard or a beautiful woman with a flowing dress. I believe simply in a God. I believe in a spiritual God. And I think it's something, of course, that I don't think the human mind will ever be able to comprehend. But we may be able to get close. But I think we have to be very careful of how far we push that throttle.
All right, Steve, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you, as always. Whenever I'm with you, the hour just flies by, as it did this morning. Let's do it again soon.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Joined the Free Britney movement, and I am somebody. If you haven't followed this, it is a story about a conservatorship gone wrong. We're going to get into this in the 3 o'clock hour, and Britney Spears is just the tip of the iceberg. And I have heard from a lot of people over the years that they or a loved one have been the victim of a conservatorship that has gone out of control. And the film I Care a Lot deals with this a little bit. And if you have any conservatorship horror stories, I'd love it if at 3 o'clock, an hour from now, you'd call in and share them with the audience, or if you know anyone that does, because this is an issue that I'm eager to bring more attention to, and we're going to do a series of shows on this, sort of like we've been doing with the Long Island serial killer, where we look at the ins and outs of conservatorships and the problems there. So that's going to be in an hour from now. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we're going to talk with legendary entertainment columnist Rona Barrett. I have been a fan of Rona Barrett's for many years, and I'm even more of a fan these days because we're going to talk with her about some of the different things she's done in her career entertainment-wise, but she is now on a mission to help senior citizens. I have a real big passion for trying to help senior citizens as well. Been very proud that throughout my entire 10 years in radio and 10 years before that, on television and other forms of broadcasting, I've always had an enormous appeal, for whatever reason, to senior citizens. And I've always felt a special kinship with senior citizens, even more so in many instances than people my own age. I have a lot of friends that are senior citizens. I may even have more friends that are seniors than I do folks that are my own age. And I am really pleased that Rona Barrett is going to such great lengths to help our senior citizens. One story I did want to comment on. Today we had the parade honoring New York City's first responders. And I thought this was a nice thing. A parade down the Canyon of Heroes is just about the greatest honor New York can give anybody. And the people that got us through the coronavirus pandemic, police, sanitation, hospital, frontline workers, these people deserve all the recognition that was bestowed upon them in this parade yesterday. And it was a nice thing. And you could tell, even with the horrible weather, the oppressive heat, the humidity, to see the – it's not technically ticker tape because they don't even really use the stuff anymore. But the confetti coming down on the parade floats, it was such a nice thing. And I was glad that the mayor chose to honor our hometown heroes. And these are people that are deserving of a great deal of recognition. But I was surprised to read yesterday that there were two public servants or classes of public servant that were absent. New York City's firefighters, New York's bravest, and New York City's correction officers, New York's boldest, were both absent from the Hometown Heroes Parade yesterday, and it's not because they weren't invited. The mayor and the parade organizers, I don't know who was responsible for organizing this parade, they invited these groups. They invited the firefighters. They invited the correction officers. But a boycott was called by their unions, the corrections union and the firefighters union. And I have a very good relationship with the leadership of both unions, quite frankly. So I'm not interested in criticizing the decision to boycott. But I think this was a mistake. Right now, a firefighter is currently ill with COVID. So in this official communication circulated ahead of the event, leaders of the Uniformed Firefighters Association called on the bravest to stand in solidarity and withhold any participation in tomorrow's parade. This is what the statement said. We're taking the stance because the time to celebrate has not yet arrived. That's according to the president of the UFA, Andrew Ansbrough. Our members are still risking their lives daily by exposing themselves to COVID-related illnesses. Indeed, we currently have a member in the ICU with COVID-related pneumonia. They added, we're going to keep him and his family in our thoughts. So none of the FDNY's 9,000 active duty firefighters were among the marchers in this parade. So they issued a public statement blasting de Blasio for not coming through with promised bonus pay for the firefighters. And I agree with them on that. They certainly should get this. But the statement said this. Last year, Mayor de Blasio called for federal funding for hazard pay bonuses. The federal government delivered that funding as part of the American Rescue Act. But to date, the mayor has failed to fulfill his promise. Rather than a parade, a more appropriate gesture would be to make good on his promise. I agree with that. They certainly should get the money that they were promised. The recording secretary of the Firefighters Union also mentioned the unidentified firefighter battling COVID, saying, we think prayers for his recovery and a memoriam for those lost is more appropriate than a parade at this time. Now, I don't agree. I think there's nothing wrong with simultaneously fighting for these bonuses, keeping this firefighter in the prayers, making him a focal point of the parade. I mean, imagine if the firefighters themselves had a, I don't know what the firefighter that's sick, I don't know what his name is, but let's say it's Johnny. Imagine if they had a float in the parade saying, be strong, Johnny, get better, Johnny. And they had the guy's wife or the guy's kids there on the float. Because I think a parade, it's not about saying, all right, let's wash our hands of this. This is over. We're never going to deal with it again. It's about celebrating people that have done a good job, whether they're sports heroes, whether it's John Glenn, whether it's our hometown heroes. And I think all the hometown heroes, firefighters and corrections included, are worthy of a parade and celebrating their accomplishments. I'd be curious to hear, and I know we have a lot of firefighters in our audience, I'd be curious to hear what you think. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Now, Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is obviously a political rival of Mayor de Blasio, last month he announced plans for an eternal flame to honor the estimated 50,000-plus New Yorkers killed by the coronavirus, surrounded by 19 maple trees, to pay tribute to various categories of essential workers, including one for firefighters. So local opposition forced Cuomo to abandon the original site of what they're calling the Circle of Heroes Monument in Battery Park City, but a spokesman said it would be relocated elsewhere in the neighborhood. What I didn't know is that the city EMT, the EMTs of the city, also boycotted Wednesday's parade over their entry-level salary of just $16.95 an hour, which is less than $2 more than the legal minimum of $15 an hour. See, I don't like this. A parade is about people putting aside their differences together for a day and celebrating the people being honored. It's not about settling every labor dispute you have. It's not about embarrassing politicians. It's not about showcasing different issues. At least in my judgment, it's not. I remember many years ago, I was working in videography at the time. I think I might have even been in school. I don't remember. But I got to walk in the parade that was honoring the New York Yankees one year because they had won the world championship, and I was videotaping the parade, or somebody in the parade. I don't remember the circumstance. But I can tell you, walking in that parade with thousands of screaming New Yorkers, with confetti falling from the sky, it is the most thrilling thing in the world. And it is so great. And to be, if you're actually able to walk in the parade as the person or the group being honored, it's a wonderful thing. And I think the city EMTs, I think the corrections officers, and I think the firefighters made a mistake by not participating. I think there would have been nothing wrong with the leadership of the firefighters union putting out a statement to its memo saying, hey, if you want to go to the parade, that's great. Nobody's more deserving of some applause and some confetti and to walk down the Canyon of Heroes than you, because you guys are heroes. Keep Johnny in mind because he's sick right now. And keep in mind the fact that all of us are still being exposed to COVID on a daily basis. But New York would not have broken the back of COVID but for your work. So that's kind of where I am on this. And if to make the bonus argument, or to make the argument about hourly wage, as the city's EMT did, what, do that tomorrow. Do that tomorrow. There'd be nothing if they called a press conference to protest what they're being paid or not being paid. Of course it would still get coverage. I don't know why they would deny their members the opportunity to participate in this. 800-848-WABC. We're going to talk with Rona Barrett in just a minute. In fact, let me take a break now, because I am eager to talk with Rona Barrett. I have a number of questions I'm going to ask her. But before I do have to talk to you about GetTheTea.com. My friend Kevin McKay, who I alluded to yesterday, who's embarking on his chronicling of his experiences using Life Change Tea, they've actually put a photo of the milk jug that I described on yesterday's program, which is a cartoon of Mr. T with the caption, "I pity the fool who doesn't drink Life Change Tea." So if you want to see what that photo looks like, just join the Facebook group. Just go on Facebook to Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's Morano Radio Fans and Haters. Join the group, and you could see the photo of that milk jug with Mr. T on it. So he's going to be chronicling his experience using Life Change Tea. I just texted Ronnie, who's the head of GetTheTea.com, to see if he wanted to come on the show tomorrow and talk to us a little bit about things that are happening in the Life Change Tea community. So anyway, Life Change Tea, if you still haven't tried it yet, is a great product, gives you a lot of energy with no caffeine, and it's designed to filter all the garbage out of your system. I once asked Ronnie, how would you describe Life Change Tea? I said, it blank. What does it do? And he said, it cleanses you. And I think that's as good a description for what it does as anything I've seen. I can tell you, my digestion is very regular and very thorough is the word I'm looking for. Very thorough after I drink Life Change Tea. It's a daily detox that cleanses you from the inside out. Go to the website, getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com and use the promo code Frank. If you do that, if you go to getthetea.com and use the promo code Frank, you'll get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. So getthetea.com, promo code Frank. If you use the promo code Frank, you will also be letting the good folks over at getthetea.com know that you heard it right here on this radio show.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano on 77 WABC. If you want to look at an industry that's just exploded in recent years, in recent decades, look no further than the field of entertainment journalism. It's now a multi-hundred billion dollar a year industry. But there was a time when members of the public, members of the press questioned whether being an entertainment reporter was even something that was viable. And I am indeed privileged to be joined by one of the pioneers in this field. Before there was TMZ, before there was Entertainment Tonight or Access Hollywood, there was Miss Rona. I am thrilled to welcome someone who's not only been a trailblazing figure in the world of entertainment journalism, but has now spent the last three decades making this world a better place through her advocacy for senior citizens. Rona Barrett, legendary gossip columnist, entertainment reporter, author, and the founder of the Rona Barrett Foundation, a leader in the cause of helping senior citizens. Ms. Rona, it is a real pleasure to have you on the radio. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, I don't think I have to talk to you anymore. You said it all.
Trust me, I think you say more with a raised eyebrow or with one syllable than I could in volume. So I'm afraid you still do need to talk to me. Now, you have been so identified with Hollywood and the entertainment business for the last, I would say, probably more than half a century, that a lot of people may not realize that you were born right here in New York City. Now, I've noticed that some people who were born in New York but move elsewhere, they always consider themselves a New Yorker. How do you identify these days? Do you see yourself as a New Yorker always, or do you see yourself as a Californian?
I am sorry to say I love New York, but I am a California girl.
And what are the key advantages of being a Californian other than you get to make that right turn on red?
That was a good thing to have in our laws at the time. I just love California. I just knew from the time I was a little girl that one day I was going to be out there in the beautiful, warm climate, and I would never have to worry about the snow and my inability to walk in the snow because I had been born with a what they once called a disability. And I had a very rare case that no one could tell my parents about until I was maybe around 10 years old, and that's when they decided that I had a very rare case of muscular dystrophy, of all things. And somehow I have managed to survive, and I just couldn't wait to get to California ever since the snows came. And I found it almost impossible to walk in the snows, and I used to freeze up and beg my mother not to send me to school and so forth and so on. So I hope you understand why I am a California girl. I love the sun.
No, certainly. And you haven't just survived. You've thrived. And you have been at this, being in the public eye, reporting on other figures in the public eye, reporting on entertainment, being a quote-unquote gossip columnist since the 1950s. And I think a lot of our listeners are very familiar with your career, a lot of the great commentary you've done over the years, a lot of the great interviews you've done over the years, maybe even some of the books that you've written over the years. But a lot of folks may not be familiar with how you got your start as an entertainment slash gossip columnist. How did you get started?
First, I'm going to say something to you. For years, I guess because you were a woman or a girl or something like a female, that if you spoke about things, you were a gossip. But I never looked at it that way. I always looked at it that I was a columnist who reported about an industry that I always thought was worth a lot more attention than the news world ever, you know, talked about it, wrote about it, et cetera. Sure, we had some great, great people who wrote great articles on movies and films and music and all of that. And I loved every part of it. And so I wanted to know everything that I could. When I went to New York University, I was studying at that school because it had the only media kind of school at the time. And so I was in communications when there wasn't even a word called communications. And so that's how I really began. But it really began when I was 13 years old. I was taken to see a show at a very famous hotel in Catskill Mountains, Grossinger's. And that night, there came onto the stage a very adorable-looking man with a magnificent voice. And I remember poking my mother in her arms and said, Mom, isn't he good-looking? Listen to his voice. He's just tremendous. And that person happened to wind up being Eddie Fisher. And that's how I really got started. I decided I had to do something for this guy and really help make him become a bigger star than he ever was at the time. And go ahead. What do you want to say?
No, I'm sure Debbie Reynolds was grateful for that. Now, you did have an eye for young talent, particularly people that might have been perceived as being handsome. I had heard, and I appreciate the sentiment behind your story as a fellow graduate of NYU myself. I actually didn't know that you went to New York University at a time when not a lot of women were going to NYU. It's pretty impressive. I had heard that you actually ended up as having as a prom date Steve Lawrence of Steve and Edie fame. Is that true?
It was not a prom date, but after Eddie Fisher, I was always being asked, can you start a fan club for people and make them what you did for Eddie Fisher? I don't think I was the only one who did anything for Eddie Fisher, but that was the beginning. And so somebody introduced me to a young man who I thought had a wonderful, wonderful voice. And his name was Steve Lawrence. And we became just the best of friends. He came to my 16th birthday party. And I don't know how those other stories happened after that, but he never took me to, he never took me out on the date.
Well, I think that certainly your advocacy for him in the entertainment world over the years certainly played a role in his meteoric rise. We're talking with Rona Barrett. Among her many claims to fame, she is the founder of the Rona Barrett Foundation, a tremendous organization, which we're going to tell you what they're up to now because they're doing some great work. If you want to learn more about them or if you want to potentially even donate, you can go to ronabarrettfoundation.org. That's Rona Barrett Foundation. foundation.org. Before I ask you about what you're doing now, which I just love, with respect to the Golden Inn and Village, I have to ask you about Frank Sinatra. I had read over the years that he was maybe not exactly pleased with some of your reporting on what he was up to. Is that accurate? And how would you characterize your relationship, professional or personal, with Frank Sinatra?
Well, I considered myself the third daughter of the Sinatra family at one point. In my early days of coming to Hollywood, one of the first people who I happened to have met was little Nancy Sinatra. And we just hit it off and became very good friends. And the next thing I knew, I was invited to parties at Mrs. Sinatra's house, the number one Mrs. Sinatra. And there on a Christmas Eve, in walked none other than Frank Sinatra. And he met me for the first time. And he said, gee, I wish you knew I knew you were here. I'd have brought you a present, too. And that was the first time that I ever said hello to Frank Sinatra. And then what he didn't like later on, but I think it was a misunderstanding of what it was that I was saying. And that was shortly after Nancy, little Nancy, was married to Tommy. And it was an unhappy kind of a breakup. Mm. And no one else was, you know, could talk to Nancy. She was really in bad shape, and I can understand when something like that happens and or occurs. And so one day I was asked to do a program about famous people, and I was asked a question, and the host of the show was Alan Ludden. And he asked me something about, did I ever think that Nancy would find a lot of happiness in marrying anyone because of who her father was and her great adoration for him, as the whole family had for him. So I said, personally speaking, I think the kind of man she wants is exactly like her father. He's got to be strong. He's got to be talented. He has to have a lot of things like that. And somehow that got misinterpreted that I said something that was I never said. And Frank got very mad at me because somebody told him this story and it was mistold to him. And so after that, Frank did everything he could to say these terrible things about me. And in doing so, he made me more famous in a way than I ever thought I'd ever become.
So, wow.
But that's the story. That's the real story about what happened.
One of the other areas of your career which has gotten a lot of attention is your time on the Tomorrow Show, Tomorrow Coast to Coast with Tom Snyder. Tom Snyder, of course, a longtime fixture in both television and radio. I think 40 years ago he was even on this station. They carried his nationally syndicated radio show. And it was very interesting when Tom Snyder was on with David Letterman talking about your joining the Tomorrow Show, how he characterized your role. This was from, I guess, about 1980, David Letterman interviewing Tom Snyder. This is what that sounded like.
Now, let me ask you about Rona Barrett. How do you get along with Rona Barrett?
I get along with her real well.
She's coming on to be your West Coast anchor, right?
Yeah. Correspondent on the 27th of October.
Now, it was interesting there that he rushed to correct David Letterman and say that you weren't an anchor, you were a correspondent. There's been a lot of things written over the last 40 years, even people like Tom Shales and Roger Ailes talking about your role on The Tomorrow Show. Setting the record straight once and for all, what was it like working on The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder?
Well, it started out, hopefully, to be a very good show, and Fred Silverman was then the head of, he was at ABC of programming, and then he was, he was at CBS, and then he went over to ABC at one point, but the Tomorrow Show was on NBC. And we got along famously. I think Tom was, Tom had me on his show maybe a half a dozen times. And when Johnny Carson decided that he no longer wanted to do 90 minutes of a show, they offered the other 30 minutes onto Tom's portion. And he said, I just can't do it myself. I need somebody else. And somebody recommended, said, did you ever think of asking Rona Barrett? And he said, that's a great idea. He said, if she wants to do it, I'd be thrilled. And that's basically what happened. And so I decided to leave ABC, which had been my longtime home when I started my career, which, by the way, is another story in itself, and took me a long time to get on television. That's all I have to say. And we got into a situation because Fred Silverman at one point wanted to have a show that that would express a lot of things like what's going on the Today Show. And he wanted new kind of material. And so we started to explore the things that we could do. And then the interviews that I was to do were to be interviews that only I should do, but I couldn't do them in New York City. I had to do them only in Los Angeles. Well, on the opening night in October of 1980, whatever it was, I don't know, something had happened, and I was able to get an interview with Mary Tyler Moore, who was married to the then head of NBC. And the interview was about Ordinary People, that wonderful movie that I just thought this was the best performance that I had ever seen Mary Tyler do. And so the interview was about Mary Tyler. And in it, of course, you know, she has a trouble with a troubled son.
Sure.
And in her real life, she was having trouble with a troubled son. And of course, he unfortunately killed himself. And she started to talk about it. And I knew that the minute I saw her up on the screen, that people cannot do this kind of a performance unless they have lived something that is a part of what this is all about. And so I said to her something about, tell me about your son and what happened. And the next thing I knew is I got a phone call from Grant Pinker, who was the head of the program and also had been married to Mary, and said, you can't run this show tonight. You just can't run it. I said, why? Mary gave me the show. Well, I went to New York City on a Sunday, when I could go there, and I did the interview that Sunday and immediately came back, and that was the program I was going to open with Tom Snyder. And from there, it just got worse. Don't ask me for reasons why. I don't know. Was it my fault? Was it somebody else's fault? Was it no one's fault? But Tom was having a difficult time himself in his personal life. And I think that it affected how he then started to treat me and how we worked together or not together. And it just wasn't good. Mm. It wasn't good. And people were seeing that I was doing one thing that was much more like investigative work in about Hollywood or different stories regarding not just the person, but issues that were going on in the world of entertainment. And he said, you know, we're not detectives here. We're not supposed to be doing this sort of thing. And of course, there was a difference of opinion with the management.
Sure.
And so one thing, it just got worse and worse. And it turned out to be the worst thing that I could have done for my career, really. And that's it.
Well, clearly, it didn't seem to slow down your career too much. You did a lot of great things after that as well. A senior correspondent for Entertainment Tonight, a whole bunch of other interesting things over the years. I don't know how active you are on social media these days, but it seems like everybody with a Twitter account or a podcast thinks that he or she can be this generation's Rona Barrett. Do you have any thoughts on how the proliferation of things like social media has changed entertainment journalism and changed the kind of reporting that you used to do?
I think TMZ was probably more responsible for what the changes were all about. It just became a new time. You know, when I came into the business, I recognized that our country was changing. And if you can't change sometimes with the times, you have a difficult experience. And so I just kept going after the stories that I thought would tell a story about what made people really tick. Who were they really? That was what I was interested in. I just wanted to know what life was like for them. As so many people, as they wrote me, is, oh, I had the same experience that I just read in a piece that you wrote about so-and-so and so-and-so. And so I was someplace else. Tom was someplace else. And it was a bad situation. But for me, I then went on. I said I was just going to continue. And then came along, you know, Good Morning America, which was much earlier in this time frame that we're talking about now. And it took me, you know, 7.5 years to convince ABC that they should do something about entertainment, especially in their hometown of Los Angeles in Hollywood. And I think I was right. I was terrible on television in the beginning. I mean, I don't even know why they let me continue. But I kept breaking little stories that somehow they became on the front pages of the LA Times. And so one night the anchor, Baxter Ward at the time, said, you know, if you had been listening to our program two nights ago, you would have known this story. And he picks up the LA Times, and there's the story of Cary Grant and Diane Cannon breaking up or something like that. And it was a big divorce story, et cetera. And that was the really beginning. And the next thing I knew, ABC at the time, or KABC at the time, had a less than a 1 rating in Nielsen. And before we knew it, nothing changed on the program. All the other anchors, you know, were still there, but the ratings kept going up and up and up. And everybody began saying, it's only because of Rona Barrett. They all want to hear what she has to say. And that's how the reputation got built.
Well, the rising ratings were something that seemed to follow you throughout all the networks that you worked on and through all the different shows that you worked on. But about 30 years ago, you made the transition from journalism to the world of helping seniors. And these days, of course, you're doing a great job with the Rona Barrett Foundation. People can learn more about it at ronabarrettfoundation.org. What led you to make that transition in your life to helping seniors as opposed to talking about and talking with celebrities?
I just felt that there was a moment in life. I was on television, I think it was close to 40 years. And I've always felt that there's a moment when you have to know when it's time to get off the stage. So I said to my husband, I said, honey, it's time to get out of Dodge. And I want to get out of Dodge now. And so when I moved to an area above Santa Barbara, my whole life really changed. I don't know what really happened. Somebody, I said, I guess because I had a little name, somebody said, would you like to come on the board of the hospital here? And things like that. And the next thing I knew, I was in the world of medicine and taking and knowing about people. And the other part of it was during my entire Hollywood career, I always had a group of women all old enough to be my mother And they were the ones who gave me the courage to continue when things just didn't come happen one day after another. You had to work for it. You had to get yourself ready for it. And every time I said, oh, well, they're never going to put me on television. Nobody believes that anything that we have to say belongs on television, even though this is a multi-million dollar industry. And the next thing I knew, it was 7.5 years later, and my mother and father had always been begging me to come back to New York City, that I had a beautiful apartment there, and that my bedroom was still there, and that they would find me a husband, and so forth and so on. And that's the story. And I said to my father that Sunday, I said, I have good news for you. He says, what's happening? I said, I'm going to come home. He said, you're what? And I said, I'm coming home. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, Dad, you never believed in anything I was doing. You always said to me, why do you think you're going to be anyone or become something that's really important or someone worthwhile? You're just a grocer's daughter. And so the next thing I knew is I was in another world. And I said, I'm coming home, Dad. And he says, you must give it 24 more hours. And I said, Daddy, please stop this nonsense. I said, what am I going to do? It's a Sunday afternoon. It's 4:00 in the afternoon. Where do you go and get an answer or make somebody change their mind about something? And he said, I don't know, but you're going to give me and promise me that you'll give me the 24 more hours. Mm. And I said, okay. And I hung up the phone and I walked around my little apartment and I said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I said, you know what? I've got nothing to lose. And I sat down and wrote a night letter to Leonard Goldenson, who was then the chairman of the board, the president, and everything else about ABC. And I said, dear Mr. Goldenson, after 7.5 years of futzing around with me, either say yay or nay, you will put me on TV. And I signed my name, Rona Vera. And I sent the night letter off. And I went to bed crying. And Wow. Then at 6:00 in the morning, the phone rings. And I said, oh, my God, hello, hello. And I hear this man's voice say, so what have you done now? And I said, who is this? He says, this is Elton Rule, general manager of KABC. He said, I just received a telephone call from Leonard Goldenson. And Leonard Goldenson said to me, could you tell me what she meant by this word, stop futzing around? and so Elton said, Leonard, I think it was something to do with another word. And he said, but you can't put that word in the night letter. And so according to way Elton told me the story, he said, well, Elton, if you want to put her on television, you have my permission to do so if you want to do it. But I want you to know one thing. If she is ever going to turn into being a really good journalist, a reporter, whatever you want to call her, I mean, you have to make sure that unless she's saying something libel, and you have to have a couple of attorneys with her, that you'll try her out. And so Elton said to me, so when can you get your backside into this office? And I said, backside? Yes. Who was ever talking about people saying words like that at that time? The next thing I knew, I was sitting there in Elton's office, and he says, I have good news and bad news for you. I said, okay. He said, which one do you want? I said, I don't care. Just tell me what it is you want to say. And I'm holding my hands underneath the couch. And I don't even know what to do with myself. And he said, Well, I can't give you the 6 o'clock news because we are just jammed at the 6 o'clock news, and I wouldn't know where to put you. But if you want to go on the 11 o'clock news, I can start you there. And I had a smile on my face because I kept saying to myself, let them give me 11 o'clock because by then everybody in Hollywood will be home because if they're working, they have to go to bed at some early time. And therefore, they'll understand some of the things that I might be saying about the business and the industry, et cetera. And that's basically what happened. And that's it.
Well, in terms of the work that you're doing with seniors, and I could talk with you all evening, and I hope you'll come back again soon, but I have to ask you about what you've done with something called the Golden Inn and Village, something I think is just terrific and could be replicated all across the country to help senior citizens who are having a tough time financially. What exactly is the Golden Inn and Village, and how's it working out there in California? And do you think this is something that could be replicated in other jurisdictions around the country?
Frank, I most definitely do. It's about affordable housing. And in affordable housing, you basically can only be earning a certain amount of money or not earning anything and just living on Social Security. And what it will do is the government in the long run, you know, helps you, but only like 30% of whatever money you are earning goes towards giving you an apartment. And so building something like this was something I had never done before in my life. And I said, but I think it sounds like it's good because there's something more to a person just having a roof over their head. It really starts with looking at their heart, their soul, their body, the way they carry themselves. And then you begin to know this is the beginning of a whole person. And how do I help treat this part of the person and not just give them a roof over their head? And so that long ago, I started other businesses hoping that some of the money that I would make would go into starting a foundation. Well, I never made enough money to really start a big foundation, but we started the Rona Barrett Foundation to help seniors. And my father then came to live with me because my mother passed away. And it was my father who really didn't encourage me about anything like what I did. But I suddenly realized, if I couldn't take care of my dad, who was going to take care of him?
Sure.
And that was the beginning. I said, I have to do something that's going to mean something so people can have a better life. You know, they talk about the golden years. These people were not going to enjoy any golden years. They don't even know what the golden years were supposed to be about. And I said, I'm going to give them the golden years. I'm going to raise money, and I'm going to give them food programs and health programs, and I'm going to get them to go to the theaters or go to the movies and have activities and do a whole bunch of other things that a lot of other nursing homes would try to do, but it's a whole different way of the way in which we do it. And so that was the beginning, and it took me 7.5 years again to get somebody to believe in what I what I wanted to do. And that was it happened one day. An architect, he came to help me, and he says, Rona, first you have to find a piece of land, and then we can figure out what you want to put on this land. And I did, and that's how we 7.5 years later, my face was on the cover of the Santa Barbara News Press, and I guess the head of the housing authority for the county of Santa Barbara saw the article, called up the architect and said, do you really know Rona Barrett? And he said, yeah, I really do. And he said, would you deliver her a message for me? And he said, go ahead, what's the message? He said, would you tell her I would love to be her partner in making this Golden Inn and Village? The next thing I knew, 3 months later, I had a contract and I had a thing. And And we started to look at property, and I bought a piece of land that was kind of beautiful, and that land became the Golden Inn Village.
Well, I'll tell you, it sounds like the most dangerous place that you can stand is between Rona Barrett and one of her goals, because you'll get run over quickly. I do hope you'll come back, because there's a lot of other things that I'm eager to chat with you about, including this new podcast you're doing called Gray Matters. If people want to learn more about what the Rona Barrett Foundation is up to, you can donate. You can even sign up for their email updates at ronabarrettfoundation.org. Before I let you go, Ms. Rona, though, I do have to ask you one final question. And this is more geared, I guess, towards my wife. But you wrote a book years ago called How You Can Look Rich and Achieve Sexual Ecstasy. I'm wondering, do you have any advice for me on how I can look rich and maybe on how my wife can achieve sexual ecstasy?
We'll have to discuss this when we're not on the air with a lot of other people.
Fair enough. Rona Barrett, thank you so much for the time this morning. I do hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you, Frank. That's very kind of you. I know I can roll on and talk too much, but that's it. You asked for it, you got it.
Believe me, it's been the highlight of my week, my month, probably my year. If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Rona Barrett, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Moreno.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Moreno.
Like Britney Spears. I wouldn't say I'm the biggest Britney Spears fan in the world, but her music is pretty good. It's music you can bob your head to. Oftentimes you can understand the music and the lyrics, and it's upbeat, it's up-tempo. It's not Frank Sinatra, it's not Dean Martin, it's not even Vic Damone. It's not music that's going to be enshrined. I don't know that people are going to be listening to Britney Spears 50 years from now. Maybe they will. Who knows? But she's got some good songs. Toxic, Give Me More. What's that song that she had initially that made her a big star? What's that song? Like, she was only like 17 when it came.
Hit Me Baby One More Time?
Yes. That one I never really liked. See, when everybody loved Britney Spears, I didn't really love her. I'm always kind of the opposite. I cut against the grain. I was more of a Christina Aguilera fan back then. But then she had some rough knocks, and then she went a little crazy after her divorce. She shaved her head. She started destroying cars. And that made me actually a bigger fan of hers, because I appreciated her kookiness. Because, well, I think I'm a little bit more stable than I have shaved my head. I've never destroyed any cars, at least not as a result of going into a flying rage. I've destroyed cars because of car accidents or things like that. But I like Britney Spears. I like her as a personality. I like her as a musician. But I don't spend much time thinking about her. And then something called the Free Britney Movement took hold. I don't know if you've heard about this. We've been talking a little bit about this on the radio. There's a documentary or a documentary series about this now. And essentially, she does not have any control over her own life and has not had any control over her own life since 2008, when she was placed under the control of a conservatorship controlled by her father. And she was in court on June 23rd trying to be freed of her conservatorship. She wants to hire her own attorney. She wants to make decisions about her life. She says she wants to get married again, wants to have another child. I think she should. Now, look, obviously, I'm sure there's another side to the story. Maybe her father, who's in control of this conservatorship, has seen a side to her that the rest of us don't know about. In my view, she should be freed. She should be able to make decisions on her own. She's one of the most successful entertainers of all time. She's made millions. I think she should be able to make decisions on her own. But the thing, much like how the Titanic made cruise line safety something that everyone was aware of and changed the face of cruise line safety, my hope is that this Free Britney movement and what we're seeing in terms of conservatorship abuse will bring attention to all the abusive conservatorships that are going on all over the country right now. Because I don't know if you've seen the movie I Care a Lot. Like, obviously, that's fiction, and there's some parts of it that are wildly unrealistic. But the central premise that there are these guardianships that get control, and there was an episode of Boston Legal about this about 16 years ago that first brought this to my attention. But there are these guardianships that get control of people's estates, and then they never let them go. They milk them for every dollar. They control every aspect of these people's lives. These guardians go before the courts, and they say that the people whose lives they're running are incompetent, and sometimes family members are involved, when the people are perfectly competent. So what I'd like to do now for the next 10 minutes or so, maybe the next 15 minutes, is invite you, if you know of a guardianship horror story, a conservatorship horror story, I don't know that there's technically a difference between a guardianship and a conservatorship. I'm sure there is, but I'm not a trust and estates lawyer. Maybe you can fill me in on that. I'd like you to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Yesterday, Britney Spears' mother, Lynn, asked that the court listen to the wishes of her daughter and allow her to hire her own legal counsel for the first time in 13 years. Imagine that. She can't even hire her own lawyer. She needs the permission of the conservatorship in order to do that. So she spoke. She went on Instagram yesterday, and usually she puts these very wordy posts out there, either via text or via video. But yesterday she just posted a photo of herself naked, a naked bathroom selfie. And you just see her back. I've posted an article from the New York Post on my Facebook page. If you want to see it, just go to facebook.com/MoranoFan. It's not salacious. It's just a photograph of her back. And I don't know that it's technically a selfie because clearly somebody else took the photo because it's taken from behind her. So it's not a selfie, even though the New York Post and other people are referring to it as a selfie. It's a photo of her naked back. And there are no captions, no comments. It's just her back and a ballet slipper emoji. So I don't know what she was trying to convey with this photograph and this message, but clearly she was trying to convey something. But for now, let's use this as an opportunity to highlight some of the abuses of guardianships and of conservatorships that are out there. Give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Meantime, they were able to – there was some leaked audio published online of Britney Spears in court. And here's a portion of her statement to the court about some of the guardianship abuse that she's seen and some of the problems with it and some of the problems that have led her to want to be liberated at this point. This is Britney Spears talking to the court.
The people who did this to me should not get away and be able to walk away so easily. Recap. I was on tour in 2018. I was forced to do. My management said, if I don't do this tour, I will have to find an attorney. And by contract, my own management could sue me if I didn't follow through with the tour. He handed me a sheet of paper as I got off the stage in Vegas and said I had to sign it. It was very threatening and scary. And with the conservatorship, I couldn't even get my own attorney. So out of fear, I went ahead and I did the tour. When I came off that tour, a new show in Las Vegas was supposed to take place. I started rehearsing early, but it was hard because I'd been doing Vegas for 4 years and I needed a break in between. But no, I was told this is the timeline and this is how it's going to go. I rehearsed 4 to 4 days a week. half of the time in the studio and half of the other time in a Westlake studio. I was basically directing most of the show with my whereabouts, where I preferred to rehearse, and actually did most of the choreography, meaning I taught my dancers my new choreography myself. I take everything I do very seriously. There's tons of video with me at rehearsals. I wasn't good. I was great. I led a room of 16 new dancers in rehearsals. It's funny to hear my manager's side of the story. They all said I wasn't participating in rehearsals, and I never agreed to take my medication, which my medication is only taken in the mornings, never at rehearsal. They don't even see me. So why are they even claiming that? When I said no to one dance move into rehearsals, it was as if I planted a huge bomb somewhere. And I said, no, I don't want to do it this way. After that, my management, my dancers, and my assistant of the new people that were supposed to do the new show all went into a room, shut the door, and didn't come out for at least 45 minutes. Ma'am, I'm not here to be anyone's slave. I can say no to a dance move. I was told by my, at the time, therapist, Dr. Benson, who died, that my manager called him in that moment and told him I wasn't cooperating or following the guidelines in rehearsals. And he also said I wasn't taking my medication, which is so dumb because I've had the same lady every morning for the past 8 years give me my same medication, and I'm nowhere near these stupid people. It made no sense at all. There was a week period where they were nice to me, and they said, I don't want to do, and I told them I don't want to do the, they were nice to me. They said, if I don't want to do the new Vegas show, I don't have to, because I was getting really nervous. I said, I can wait. It was like, they told me I could wait. It was like lifting literally 200 pounds off of me when they said I don't have to do the show anymore, because it was, I was really, really hard on myself, and it was too much. I couldn't take it anymore. So I remember telling my assistant, but you know what? I feel weird if I say no. I feel like they're going to come back and be mean to me or punish me or something.
So this goes on for another few minutes. I'm not going to play the whole thing. But clearly, this is someone who, one, seems like she knows what's going on. A little quirky, maybe. Okay. But she's also someone who clearly is living under the thumb of someone else. That's forcing her to make decisions she doesn't want to make. And I think that's a real shame. So I'd be curious if you know of anyone out there that is similarly situated. I'd be very disappointed and very surprised if there's no one out there. But give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And if you want to read the article that summarizes where we are now and to see the Instagram back naked selfie that Britney Spears has posted, you can go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan. We'll take your calls on other subjects as well. Charlie is in Flatbush. Hello there, Charlie. Oh, excuse me. Charlie's in Hell's Kitchen. Hello there, Charlie.
Yeah, hello, Frank. Great interview with Rona Barrett. You have some really good interview skills. You do your job really well. That's great.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask if she had some good Tom Snyder stories, because I was a little kid when I got a chance to watch that. I would watch it in the summer when we didn't have school the next day. And you could tell, even as a little kid, that the two of them, especially him, Tom Snyder, they didn't like each other at all. I mean, it was obviously the little kid watching them, but, you know, the show, The Tomorrow Show, came on right after Johnny Carson. But it was just obvious. I wanted to know if she had any good Tom Snyder stories, but you did at least raise that in your interview with her.
Well, yeah, because I noticed the same thing you did. I mean, it was clear that she and Tom Snyder didn't exactly see eye to eye, and she pretty much said as much. And I know both of them have, I mean, Tom Snyder's no longer with us, but they both of them have talked about it over the years. That happens. You know, sometimes people at different points in their lives just don't see exactly eye to eye. It happens. Well, thank you for the call, Charlie. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Rick is in New Jersey. Hello there, Rick.
Good morning, Frank. This is just a quick question. 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, I sent you a present, and nobody can tell me if you ever got it. Did you ever get the coffee I sent?
The coffee? What kind of coffee was it?
Death Wish coffee.
Oh, yeah. We got it. We've been drinking. I had a cup yesterday. Christian said that that somebody sent it, but they didn't sign their name or anything.
No, I can't, because you got to send your name, and there's no way to put anything in it.
Yes, we absolutely did get it.
Christian has is storing it in his locker, and he's parceling out a K-cup for me at a time.
Yeah, not too many, Frank.
Yes, no, trust me. I'm going to drink it responsibly.
I just wanted to make sure you got it.
Yeah, well, that's very thoughtful of you. Thank you.
I enjoy seeing you. First.
Well, very nice of you. I appreciate it. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Neil is on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Frank. I wanted a couple of things. In the news before, you mentioned that they're replacing the elevator in Flatbush Avenue, the only one that's working at that station. It's going to take them 6 months. How the heck does it take 6 months to put an elevator? The shaft is already there. You could put an apartment building up in 6 months.
You know, I don't know anything about that story. That was a story Christian brought to our attention. I'll invite him to comment. But it would not surprise me if anything involving the MTA was primarily defined by incompetence and inefficiency.
Hey, that's why there's no money around with these agencies. I mean, they spend it. There's no accountability. The other thing I want to say was, you know, on every year, I enjoy watching the Capitol Fourth on PBS. And this year, I was actually stunned that Vanessa Williams sang the Black National Anthem during the show, number one. It couldn't be a more racist song. I mean, if you imagine singing a White National Anthem or Hatikva or Deutschland über alles, I mean, it's ridiculous. Just ridiculous.
Yeah, I spoke about that Monday with Juliet and then Tuesday with Lauren Conlon. I know a lot of people were upset by it. I didn't watch it. I never watch it. You know, I don't get worked up too much about these things, but a lot of other people do. My attitude, whether it's the 4th of July fireworks display or whether it's anything else, a sporting event, my attitude is if you don't like the performance because of politics or because of a perceived lack of patriotism or anything else, just don't watch it. I'm a big believer in laissez-faire. Do as you like. You don't want to watch. You don't want to listen. Fine. Don't listen. It, you know, but I agree. I don't know. I still haven't gotten an answer on this. If she just did the Black National Anthem or if she did both the Black National Anthem and the Star Spangled Banner. I'm not sure. 800-848-WABC. But I don't actually want to put in the effort to find out, because let's say the answer is she did both. How is my life any different? Let's say the answer is she just did the Black National Anthem. What does that mean? I go on the radio and scream about it? I'm over it. I'm over it. I'm moving on. 800-848-WABC.
And to answer part of Neil's question, I guess, about why it may be taking so long, the modernization of that elevator shaft will include updating the equipment, a new elevator cab, new equipment in the cab, a new shaft and pit. The MTA is also renovating the machine room of the elevator and updating the surveillance and fire alarm systems in that station.
Very nice. Okay. See, you got an answer there from Christian. 800-848-9222. Norman is in Brooklyn. Hello there, Norman.
Hey, good, fine. You were asking if somebody with conservatorship horror stories.
Yes, tell me.
I have a client. I'm a trainer. I've been training this guy for 20 years. He lives on the Upper East Side. He's emotionally disturbed. He's 63 or 64 years old. He's never worked in his life. He doesn't really do anything. He's very intelligent. And his mother, who's 90 years old, absolutely controls every aspect of his life. She pays his apartment. I mean, this story is, I think, somewhat common in New York City. She pays everything, but he can't really have girls over. She doesn't approve of the girls. He can't have boys over because he's bisexual, and she doesn't approve of that. He's absolutely dependent upon this 90-year-old mother, who's now there's an older brother. The older brother is functioning. He's a professor, and I think he's going to control the money. And I don't see him being so sympathetic to pay for this brother anymore. And I don't see this ending very well.
So what then would happen? Let's say the mother passes away and the brother gets control of this conservatorship, and you don't see – what happens?
You see, I don't exactly know, but I know that he doesn't get along with the brother. His brother, who owns a big house in Boston, has never invited his emotionally disturbed brother to come to that house. And he's lived there like 30 years already, or 40 years. And I've always implored him, please, you know, try to get a job. Try to do something for yourself.
Well, it sounds like what he really needs is a lawyer, you know, like Britney Spears is trying to get. I mean, it sounds like he's in a little bit of a situation different than Britney Spears. But the fact of the matter is they're both in need of somebody to look out for their interests. And it doesn't seem like anybody's doing that.
Well, you know, he trusts his mom has a lawyer. I said, well, what's going to happen if your mom dies? Oh, the lawyer is going to, everything will be fine. My mom says everything's going to be fine. I said, how do you know that? You know, I said, you got to get, Eddie, you got to like, just to look into this a little bit more. I said, you may need to speak to a lawyer on your own.
Right, but this person...
No. See, that would absolutely frighten him, because he's always concerned that the mother's going to pull the money away.
Right. No, I can understand that. And I think the emotional and psychological captivity in some ways is even more paralyzing for some of these folks than the legal captivity. Now, it sounds like your client, it sounds like he is not able to function on his own, that it is proper that he is under a conservatorship of some sort.
Here's the thing. If he would have been my son, if I would have had a son, I would have attempted to make him a little self-sufficient. Being that these people are like, this is very old money. We're talking Rembrandts on the wall, man. I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, and, you know, being that there's like lots and lots of money, nobody's ever worked in their life, it strikes me. I don't know. He's incredibly spoiled. I mean, if he was my son, he wouldn't be the way he is.
Sure. You know? I'm trying to figure out, Norman, and is he spoiled or is he unable to function?
He's spoiled. He's on loads and loads of medication. For depression, he's got psychiatrists calling him like 3 days a week. He has a functional mental illness, but I don't know if this is a functional mental illness that he could have been, he would be functioning a little bit more, a lot bit more. I think if he would have parents like my parents, okay, who wouldn't have stood for their son to lay around in the apartment all day.
Right. Maybe I'm not being clear. I'm trying to figure out if this is somebody who was spoiled and that's why he's not working, or if he's not working because he's not able to work because of a disability, because there is a pretty significant difference. As far as Britney Spears goes, it's clear to me she's able to work, and she might not make great decisions for herself, but she's able to make decisions for herself. And as far as I'm concerned, she should certainly be able to. Now, I mentioned this at the time of the Talkers Magazine conference, and very pleased still to be number 94 on the Talkers Heavy 100. Better to be 94 than number 101. These are the 100 most influential talk show hosts in America. But Brian Kilmeade gave a great speech, and the video of it is now available at talkers.com. And he was introduced by a gentleman I've had as a guest on this show. He's been one of the leading commentators chronicling the Long Island serial killer situation. But years before that, he and I were very close political allies. And from 2000 till about 2010, he and I, his name's Frank McKay, he and I were incredibly close friends and very close partners politically. He and I were very close political compatriots. I was sort of like a lieutenant in the New York State Independence Party to him. And we had a falling out in 2010 over politics. It's always over politics. And I think we both did some things that we regret. And we didn't speak for about 10 years. Over the summer, last summer, about a year ago, we had dinner. We patched things up. Big thank you to PR specialist Todd Shapiro, who put us together to break bread. And then that was pretty much the last time I saw him. I talked to him a couple times. And then
he comes to the Talkers Magazine conference to introduce Brian Kilmeade. Gives a great introduction. This is what he says.
Frank Morano, this guy is up all night, then he does the morning
show. Let's hear the Frank McKay.
And now, my pleasure to present the introducer of our keynote speaker. Let's welcome talented talk show host Frank McKay of Long Island News Radio, WRCN-FM.
Well, I hope everyone enjoyed their lunch, and I apologize if everybody's been doing this all morning, but before we even get started again, can we give a big hand for Talkers Magazine, Michael Harrison and Matthew Harrison? These guys are unbelievable, just unbelievable. The next speaker, everyone knows him. He's a Long Island native. He's one of the pride of Long Island. His career has been unbelievable. I consider myself a workaholic, and I'm surrounded by workaholics. But somehow or another, this guy gets more done in 24 hours than anybody I've ever met in my life. And I mean it sincerely. He's been working 6 hours. He's been on the air 6 hours a day for 6 days a week since 2006. As an author and a historian, he finds facts that have either been overlooked or completely ignored for hundreds of years. He's a best time and a best-selling author for five times over. He's putting together an unbelievable career. He's put together a great career. You know him from Fox and Friends and certainly from the Brian Kilmeade Show. And he has broke the top 10 for most powerful radio shows in the country just recently. And let me bring up our friend, Brian Kilmeade.
Now, that's a very nice introduction. It's perfect. It's very similar to the introduction I would have given. But it wasn't me. It was Frank McKay. As somebody that I didn't speak to for about 10 years, and I had seen, you know, just once since then. Then, Brian Kilmeade, who knows Frank McKay, and who knows me, I've drank with him, he's been a guest on the show, comes out right after that introduction, that glowing introduction from Frank McKay, who I guess, I don't know if he sponsored this segment, but I know he's thrown book parties for Brian Kilmeade before, and then Brian Kilmeade comes out and says the following.
Frank Morano, this guy is up all night, then he does the morning show right after. He's kind enough to put me in when I'm riding to work in the morning around 4 o'clock. I could have a later slot, but Frank insists I'm best at 4 a.m. I had no idea he had that kind of confidence in me. Thanks so much, everyone, for coming out to be anywhere, to not have it last year, to not have anything last year.
So he thanks me, Frank Morano, and then makes a reference to coming on this show all the time. So he's introduced by Frank McKay. And then he thanks Frank Morano, and then he talks about this show. I'm not sure who should be more insulted, if it's Frank Morano, who he clearly doesn't recognize, or if it's Frank McKay. Now, if you watch the video, and you can see it for yourself at talkers.com, we do look a little, from a distance, we do look a little bit alike in that we're both kind of short. We're both a little, you know, on the stocky side. But I thought that was very funny that of all the people that Brian Kilmeade could confuse me with, he or confuse Frank McKay with, he chooses to confuse him with somebody that hasn't spoken to me in 10 years. Again, all's good between us now. He's been on the show and everything. But I thought it was very funny. So, all right, we're going to do the AC report with David Danzis in just a minute, one of the finest journalists dealing with Atlantic City anywhere. But I do want to talk to you about my friends at Trinity Rehab. These folks are great. They will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. Don't be fooled. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting-edge, state-of-the-art stuff. They have the EPAP machine. It's FDA-approved, non-surgical, acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing. Gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back or neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, and knee pain. In just 3 5-minute sessions, you could be virtually pain-free thanks to this EPAP machine. Get started right away by calling 800-518 1-800-273-0977. Again, no prescription necessary. They're in Clifton. They're in Paramus. They're in Wayne. They're in Short Hills. They're in Emerson. They're in East Windsor. They're in Shrewsbury. They're in Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab, 800-518-0977, or go to the website trinity-rehab.com.
When the sun starts to shine, leave your worries behind. Down the coastline is where I'll be. On the boardwalk, in a car, resorts is where we start. It's where I left my heart. It's AC.
Well, it's that time of the week. It is 3:30 on Thursday morning. It is time for people listening across the 30 states of our fine union and even our neighbor to the north, Canada, to hear about the Vegas of the East, the place that I absolutely love, a place that is nationally, probably even internationally known, whether you call it America's Playground or something else, Atlantic City, New Jersey, Monopoly City, and here to help guide us through everything that's happening in Atlantic City these days is the lead writer for PlayNJ and the former casino in Atlantic City political reporter for the press of Atlantic City, one and only David Danzis. David, thank you as always for being available and awake at this unusual time.
Frank, it is my pleasure to be on with you.
So, David, again, I've been lucky enough to chat with you before. I've been enjoying your writing for years. But remind folks, what exactly is PlayNJ?
Sure. PlayNJ is an affiliate. It's a gambling affiliate website of Catena Media. We're a larger umbrella company, lots of great gambling-related websites under our umbrella. Not just PlayNJ, but we have sister sites like PlayPA if you're in Pennsylvania. We also have things like The Lines if you're really into sports betting, or Legal Sports Report, Online Poker Report. So we're a really multifaceted gambling affiliate company, but we cover gambling-related news for my money better than anybody else in the biz.
Well, and that's been my experience as a reader. And I haven't been to Atlantic City in a few months. I'm hoping to go this Friday, but this has been my longest drought in quite some time, at least since the pandemic. And I'm hoping to get back there. The last time I was in Atlantic City, I conceived a child, which is why I think my wife doesn't want me going back there anytime soon. But tell me and tell the folks listening what things are like for Atlantic City gamblers right now. The last time I was there, wherever you would go in terms of the gambling tables, there were plexiglass barriers everywhere, and both the patrons, the gamblers, and the dealers were all wearing masks. What's the situation like right now in terms of the environment on the floor?
Well, as we sit here in July, it feels like all of that was a very, very bad dream. It is all gone. If you are vaccinated, you no longer have to wear a mask, you know, kind of going on the honor system there. But most people aren't wearing masks inside anymore. All the glass partitions are down. All the slot machines are back on. Social distancing rules are out the window. Nightclubs are opening back up. Restaurants are open at full capacity. And then, of course, we had the big one that just went into effect over the 4th of July weekend. And that was that the temporary smoking ban inside Atlantic City casinos has now been lifted.
Well, I want to ask you about this because this is something that I've been waiting for since last year. And because I am a cigar smoker and I enjoy, you know, a cigar at the B bar or wherever else, a lot of the other casino bars. But just on the masking front, one of the things that I noticed even pre-pandemic is and again, maybe this is culturally insensitive for me to phrase it this way, but a lot of the folks around New York City that tended to wear masks on a regular basis are they happen to be Asian, either from Asia or of Asian descent. And when I'm in Atlantic City, a lot of the people that I would see at the Baccarat table, the Pai Gow table, they happen to be Asian. So there are a lot of Asian gamblers in Atlantic City. Have you noticed Are the Asian gamblers still wearing masks, even though they're not required to now, or are most of them maskless as well?
It's tough to sort of make that broad generalization because, you know, by that same token, if you do go into some of these Asian gaming rooms and the casinos, you'll notice that a lot of the Asian players are also smokers themselves.
Mm.
I would say that they're almost disproportionate, more likely to be smokers than your average player out on the floor, you know, playing blackjack or Caribbean stud or something like that. So I can't say definitively or even, you know, a gut feeling whether it's more Asian players are wearing masks or not. I will tell you, the people who are still sort of wearing masks more so than others are the dealers.
Hmm.
And
that's voluntary, not mandatory.
Correct. And I think that is, just sort of a habit at this point for a lot of them. B, you know, there's still some uncertainty about what's going on in the greater scheme of things for some folks. We also have to sort of look at vaccination numbers and realize that communities of color and communities of low income are not being vaccinated at the same rates as other communities. And let's not kid ourselves, the majority of Atlantic City employees live in Atlantic City. Therefore, they fit both of those descriptors.
Right.
It's employees that are wearing masks more so than anybody else inside the Atlantic City casinos.
Interesting.
Right now.
Okay, so July 4th weekend, the big news, as you just mentioned, is the smoking prohibition, which has been in place since casinos reopened with the pandemic, is no longer with us. So where you can smoke in all the places that you were formerly able to smoke?
Absolutely. So Atlantic City casinos were exempted from the state's Smoke-Free Act, which, you know, went into effect over a decade ago. And then through local law, Atlantic City permitted smoking on up to 25% of any casino gaming floor. So as long as the area is a designated smoking area, you are allowed to smoke. Again, I'm totally with you, Frank. I enjoy my cigars. I enjoy a nice glass of bourbon or whiskey when I'm at a casino. But let's not kid ourselves. I mean, putting a smoking section in a casino is akin to putting a peeing section in a pool. It doesn't really do a whole lot in the bigger scheme of things. With that being said, casinos have some of the best ventilation systems of any place you are ever going to step foot in. And that was even pre-pandemic. Since then, you know, places like Resorts Casino Hotel have invested millions and millions of dollars in updating their ventilation systems to make sure that their guests and their employees feel safe. I never want to use the word safe because I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to go that far out on a limb. But obviously, the intent is to make people feel safe and provide them an additional level of comfort than they normally would. But yeah, smoking is back. Obviously, it's you know, causing quite a bit of controversy in some circles.
Mm.
But at this point, you know, the casinos are in favor of it. They want it back. Not all of their employees are in that same boat, but it is what it is. And yes, I walked into the casinos in the wee hours of Sunday morning to go get my fix. And you know, one of the first things I noticed was the Astros were back, and that made me a pretty happy guy.
So talk to me about the controversy involved here. I read in your writing and in some of the other coverage on this that there were people that were hoping that the smoking ban within casinos would be made permanent. Is that being driven primarily by the casino workers? And is their union advocating pretty strongly for this?
Yeah, so this was something, again, that goes back to the pre-pandemic days. And the dealers union here in Atlantic City represents about 1,500 dealers. They, as a union, had taken the stance that they wanted all the casinos to go non-smoking. When the pandemic hit, you know, obviously that just sort of shored up their opposition to the indoor smoking. But there's also nonprofit advocacy groups. There's both a national group and there's a local chapter that advocate for smoke-free casinos across the United States and in all commercial gambling establishments. It's a growing trend. I mean, we can't bury our heads in the sand and pretend that things aren't what they are. Almost 20 states at this point are completely non-smoking, including most of New Jersey's competition. You know, Maryland is completely smoke-free. Massachusetts is completely smoke-free. New York is completely smoke-free. It's really, really tough. And Atlantic City casinos have always prided themselves on being a place where adults can go and be adults. And, you know, smoking is one of those things that is supposed to be for adults.
Right.
It's supposed to be, you know, something that if that's what you choose to do, you should be able to do it. And for a variety of reasons, smokers have sort of become second-class citizens in the United States. And this is just continuing that trend. But yes, the push to end smoking inside Atlantic City casinos is primarily being driven by their own employees.
What is the policy now that New Jersey is moving forward with legalized recreational marijuana? What is the policy in these casinos and in these smoking areas of the casinos with respect to smoking marijuana there?
So at this point, there is no official policy. And the reason is because New Jersey, as famous as it is for, you know, slow government and the wheels of government turning very slowly, we're sort of in this purgatory area when it comes to marijuana in New Jersey, because it's decriminalized for possession and use. It's not technically legalized in the sense that we sort of attribute that word. You know, you can't go and buy it anywhere. You can't sell it anywhere. At this particular moment, the casinos themselves have no official policy. You can smoke in your hotel room. You know, they sort of have this don't ask, don't tell kind of attitude to it. You know, they're not going to bust your chops if you're smoking a joint or doing something like that inside your hotel room. I can tell you this, though, in talking to the casino executives, you're going to see a policy that's very similar to the way Las Vegas treats it. And the reason for that is
when I was in Las Vegas, there was smoking marijuana everywhere.
Correct. But you're not allowed to smoke it on the casino floor, at least per official casino policy. And the reason for that is because it's still federally illegal. So there's a lot of concern and worries, if you will, about crossing federal banking laws and issues with federal currency when it comes to doing something illegal on your property.
Interesting.
So casinos, which are notoriously a highly regulated and tightly watched industry, are very, very weary of crossing that line with the federal government and allowing something that's still technically federally illegal on their properties. So until that changes, you know, don't expect, you know, to be able to light up a doobie at the blackjack table at Tropicana, but it's probably coming.
Got it. Well, so what is the situation overall, the kind of the summer scene like in Atlantic City? I was looking at trying to book a room for Saturday, and they were all outrageously expensive. And then I called the Borgata. I said, how much for a room on Saturday? They said, oh, we're all sold out. I said, even for a rate, you're sold out? They said, yeah. So I'm guessing things are pretty crowded back there, and tourism has come back in a big way. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. We started seeing it in May. You know, things really started picking up, and Atlantic City was behind a lot of other places in sort of this post-pandemic recovery. And the reasons for that were because there were still state-imposed restrictions here in New Jersey and Atlantic City. So obviously, you know, our gaming market recovered a little bit slower. But in May, we really started seeing it. I mean, brick-and-mortar revenue, which is something that's really, really important, obviously, to the casinos, is almost back to 2019 levels. Obviously, online gaming is still going through the roof. That hasn't slowed down at all since the casinos have reopened. And sports betting is just continuing to just put up absolutely monster numbers here in New Jersey. So for all intents and purposes, things look like they're back to normal. As always, as somebody who's covered this industry for a very, very long time, I always sort of put blinders on when it comes to the summer, because the summer doesn't really tell me anything about what's happening. It's very artificial and sort of, you know, it's just the nature of the beast of being at the Jersey Shore. I'm more interested in what happens in September, October, and November when people go back to school and, you know, people are no longer concerned with coming down to the Jersey Shore. How will the casinos fare then? My gut is telling me that things are going to be well, are going well. From what I'm being told by the casino executives, things are going in the right direction. The big one was that they got conventions and trade shows back, Frank. And this is something that, you know, people like you and I don't ever think about when we talk about casinos. It is so important to their business. If they don't have people coming in there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays for, you know, the cigar rollers convention or something of that nature, just to stay on topic there, that's what really drives their shoulder season business. So, you know, if you ask me that question again in 3 months, I might have a different answer. But right now, if you're on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, or even if you're out in the marina at those three casinos, yeah, you're going to have a difficult time getting a hotel room because there's a pent up demand for customers and they've been dying to get out for over a year. And, you know, what better place to go than a casino where sort of everything is right there for you and you don't have to really pack up the car and go here and go there. It's all there. So, yeah, Atlantic City is recovering. It's recovering really, really nicely. You know, we've got the air show coming next month. We've got huge concerts coming back. Everything seems to really be back on the road to normal, and it feels good.
That's exciting. It's really exciting. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with David Danzas as part of our weekly look at what's happening in Atlantic City. He's the lead writer for a website called PlayNJ, which if you're a gambler, or especially a gambler in New Jersey, it really is required reading. What was the 4th of July scene like down there, David?
It was absolutely nuts, Frank. You know, obviously there were fireworks shows with two casinos had one on the boardwalk, one in the marina. But I'll tell you, I mean, the boardwalk, it reminded me of when I first came down here years ago and Hard Rock and Ocean were about to open. And there was this pent up excitement, this anticipation of just sort of permeating down the boardwalk. And that's what it felt like on 4th of July. People were celebratory. They were happy. Yes, it smelled like marijuana up and down the boardwalk, which, you know, I didn't mind. I know some do. For me personally, it wasn't the worst thing in the world. But, you know, you've got open containers now on the boardwalk. So it was a party-like atmosphere on 4th of July, which is what it should be, right? I mean, we're celebrating a joyous occasion. It should be a celebration, and it absolutely was.
Right, especially in Atlantic City, no doubt about it. Now, you alluded to the time right before Hard Rock and Ocean opened, and mm-hmm. people things were just ready to pop. Those two properties, which are right next door to one another, they just celebrated their 3-year anniversary. And I remember I was down there for the opening of both properties. They opened the same weekend. And Steve Sweeney, the president of the state Senate then and now, announced at the opening festivities for Hard Rock, he basically said, he said there are going to be 1 million people in Atlantic City this weekend, which when you think of how small Atlantic City actually is, that's pretty remarkable. Now that we've had 3 years of both of these properties open and operating, including one very challenging year in light of the pandemic, what is the analysis? What is the review of these two properties look like after 3 years? How are they doing financially? How have they fit into sort of the culture of Atlantic City?
Sure. If you remember when those two properties opened, there was some consternation about could Atlantic City handle two additional properties.
Right. And just so people who may not be as familiar with the history, Atlantic City had 12 casinos. They were not able to sustain 12 casinos. And then you saw a whole bunch of them. I think you saw five of them close. You were left with 7 casinos. And then they were all doing well. They were all able to sustain the reduced competition. And then when you had these two new properties open, there was a lot of fear that they'd be cannibalizing the existing gambler's market.
Great analysis, Frank. Absolutely spot on. Yeah, and that was the issue. So people were concerned. At first, it didn't seem like that was happening. And part of that was because Ocean struggled a little bit at the beginning and Hard Rock really kind of floundered at the first couple months. Since then, it's been all systems go for both of those properties. They've completely taken off. They are number 2 and number 3. Hard Rock is number 2. Ocean is number 3 in the Atlantic City market in terms of land-based gaming revenue. So that's the revenue from the slot machines and the table machines and the poker rooms. they've really solidified their place in this market. The flip side of that is they have cannibalized Atlantic City.
Mm.
Their growth is coming at the expense of the other seven properties that were here before they opened, particularly Borgata. And listen, Borgata has nothing to worry about in Atlantic City. I mean, it is head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of revenue and what and the business that it does. But Hard Rock and Ocean are nipping at their heels, particularly Hard Rock. And what's really interesting about Hard Rock doing that is most of Hard Rock's executive team, or a good portion of it, are former Borgata employees.
Well, again, I'm not shedding any tears for the Borgata. They should be offering better comps and five times odds at the craps table the way they used to. You know, they got to keep up with the competition.
Things changed when MGM took complete control of Borgata. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. For your listeners who may remember, Borgata was jointly owned by MGM and then a smaller gaming company called Boyd. And Boyd really was responsible for running that property day to day. And people loved Boyd Gaming. When MGM took over 100%, you know, the attention to the guest changed a little bit.
Sure.
And who their desired guest was. Not sure how that's really working out for them now and how it's going to work going forward. But, you know, Hard Rock really took a page out of Borgata's book and targeted higher roller players. And then Ocean very much did the same thing. A lot of former Borgata employees ended up at Ocean.
Mm.
Realizing that, you know, it's a luxury property on the boardwalk. It's basically Borgata on the boardwalk.
No, that's for sure. David, I have to run, but before we end our conversation, I have to ask you, I saw you on Twitter recently drinking vodka out of a plastic pouch. What is this Deep Eddie man. Vodka that you were drinking?
So my joke, that was my adult Capri Sun. I got it at the Bally's Beach Bar, and they have this great selection of drinks that you can get, and they're made to just – they have little finger holes so you can just dip your straw in it. You grab it with your two fingers and you go right out onto the beach and plop down on your towel or your chair. And there you've got this 32-ounce concoction of adult libation. So
outstanding. Outstanding. Good
awesome,
for you.
Man.
David, let me know if you're around Friday or Saturday and you want to meet up for a cigar. I'd love to see you at the B-Bar. Bourbon on me.
You got it, man. Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. David Danzas, check him out regularly. He's the lead writer for Play NJ. And if you are in Atlantic City this weekend, I'm about 90%. I have a room booked for Friday, so I'm 90% sure that I'm going. Hit me up. Let me know if you're around. Text me, 8168-MORANO. I'll be happy to meet you for a drink as well. Now, if you are interested in an attorney, you need to think about the law firm of Angiuli & Gentile. They do a lot of great stuff. They do, unfortunately, they do divorce law. They do prenuptial agreements. They do trusts and estates. But their bread and butter, their specialty, the thing they do better than anybody else, is workers' compensation. They are the workers' compensation specialists, and they have been for over 35 years. And Angiuli & Gentile takes the fear out of the workers' compensation process. They'll help you get the medical treatment and the workers' compensation process payments that you're entitled to. Give them a call, 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-COMP. They offer both in-person consultations or contactless video appointments. 888-234-COMP. That's 888-234-2667.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Other Side of Midnight. Happy to take your calls on any subject. 800-848-9222. We were talking a little earlier about Atlantic City. I like going there. And one of the things that you see when you go there, if you go to a bar at a hotel or a casino, is you will generally see, I don't know if this has changed at all post-pandemic. I don't think it has. But one of the things that you will see are, I don't like to use the term prostitutes because it sounds so, I don't know, like they're alien. You see call girls, right? And you will see women that will try to solicit you to pay them to have sex. That is very common. Even though prostitution is not legal in Atlantic City, that is a very common occurrence. It's all, where it is legal in Nevada, forget about it. You certainly see it. Now, in New York, we have seen a movement towards decriminalization of prostitution. And the more I've studied this issue, the more I've talked with people from law enforcement, the more I've talked with people who have been sex workers in the past and who are sex workers now, and I've known many of them, never in the biblical sense, I have come ultimately to believe that the best long-term solution is to decriminalize prostitution. And they call it the world's oldest profession for a reason. And if someone wants to engage in a commercial transaction where person A pays person B to have sex, I think it should be legal. I think it should be regulated. And I think it should be taxed. My view is that this would allow the protections for the person paying for sex. It would allow protections for the prostitute, so they're not robbed, so they're not assaulted, so they're not exploited in some manner. Because unfortunately, you know, we've been chronicling this with the Long Island serial killer and the Gilgo Beach killings. Sex workers feel as if they have no rights and no protections. And if a sex worker is robbed, they're afraid to go to the police because they're involved in an illegal profession. So that's what New York is doing. New York is gradually moving towards decriminalization. Well, I was listening to the Cats at Night show yesterday, and it's a great show. You should listen every day because you never know who's going to pop up on that show. Any given day, you could see Curtis Sliwa followed by Alan Dershowitz. You could see Bill O'Reilly followed by the head of the Queens Chamber of Commerce. You could see Jeanine Pirro followed by the head of the Brooklyn Public Library. You just never know. It's a cornucopia. It's like this show a little bit. It's variety. You just never know what you're going to hear. There's all sorts of different perspectives. And John kind of plays mad scientist a little bit in that he has all these different folks from in the studio at the same time. You could see Governor Patterson in studio with Governor Pataki, Kevin McCullough with Liddy Serrano. You get the picture. If you're not listening, you should be. So they were talking to John Solomon, who's currently with the website Just the News. He was formerly a columnist for The Hill, longtime investigative journalist as well. And one of the things that John does, and I've got to adapt this in terms of my own interview technique, I think, and I've never thought to do this, but John does this very effectively. He ends the interview by saying, "Is there anything else you want to say?" And interestingly enough, John Solomon brought to my attention a story that I hadn't heard. And this is the 77 WABC clip of the day from yesterday's edition of the Cats at Night program.
I have a really fun story that I think most Americans probably haven't heard of, and it really jumps out at me as I look at it. Texas is going to become the first state in the entire republic to make a felony any effort to buy sex. This is an effort to try to end the horrific sex trafficking that's going on in America. Texas has passed the first felony law to make any act, any commercial person of a sex act or person to be a felony. And I think you'll see this become a trend in other states, particularly those around the border that have seen this extraordinary uptick in sexual human trafficking since the border opened up under President Biden.
John, is it for the sex workers or for the patrons of the sex workers?
It's both? For the patrons. So yeah, those who are on the buying side of the transaction. Yeah. So one of the new novel tools that might be used to fight the horrible scourge of human trafficking.
So Texas is going to make prostitution a felony. Quick piece of – I'll ask the question since you don't have – so you don't have to. Christian, what is a felony?
It's a crime where you end up going to jail for a lot of years.
Well, sort of. You're 90% right.
Actually, I know it's misdemeanors is kind of like a almost, I don't want to say slap on the wrist, but you, a maximum number of years you go to jail is like one or two, and you usually get hit with a fine.
Okay. Well, you're 70% right there. Molly, by the way, thank you for call screening today. I know that you've been working all sorts of crazy hours for 12 days straight, so thank you for coming in. I hope you're having fun making the most of the show. Do you want to straighten Christian out on his definition of misdemeanor versus felony?
Misdemeanors carry a maximum sentence of 3 months or a year of probation. Maximum fine is 500. Felony charges are filed for the most serious crimes like robbery, murder, blah, 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 range from at least 1 year to life in prison.
So you said it. So that is the difference. A year is the magic number. A misdemeanor is a crime for which you cannot be incarcerated for more than a year. And this is important for you to know because people throw out these terms, misdemeanor, felony, and nobody knows what they actually mean. This is important for you to know, so take note of this. A misdemeanor is a crime for which, if you're convicted, you can go to prison or jail for no more than a year. A felony is a crime if you're convicted, the penalty is more than a year. So that's the magic number that makes something from a misdemeanor to a felony. So think of what Texas is doing here. Texas is saying if you're caught patronizing a prostitute, you will go to prison for a year or more. I have to tell you, now, there is nobody that is more concerned about the border situation than me. It's one of the first things that attracted me to President Trump. It's one of the things that I've always loved about Pat Buchanan. It's one of the reasons that I put up with Steve from Manhattan's calls. The border situation is out of control. It's not only out of control from an economic standpoint. It's out of control from a national security standpoint and from a human rights standpoint, because what John Solomon said there about the motivation for this bill is correct. You do have sexual exploitation of minors. I don't think the solution to sexual exploitation of minors is to stiffen penalties on prostitution. I think it's to increase protections for sex workers, because if it were legal, you'd be able to regulate it in a way that you wouldn't see these 13-year-old migrant girls being sex workers. And I think the broader solution is we need to get a hold of the border situation to begin with before we deal with the people that are flooding across the border. But that's a separate discussion. So I'd love to know where you come down on this. Do you think states like Nevada are going to in the right direction where they've decriminalized prostitution? Or do you think states like Texas, where they've made it an actual felony, the first state in the country to do so, are going in the right direction? That is the question.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
Dial 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And the person who greets you will be the very, very hardworking Molly. You're welcome to comment on other issues as well. Patrice is in Brooklyn. Hello, Patrice.
Yes, hi, Frank. It's Baina Patrice, actually. And I just wrote a note because I wanted to speak with you about smoking and SARS. But in regards to the subject that you're on now, I would say, having been in medical school and at Seton Hall Law School.
Wow.
I would say.
You've done medical school and law school?
Yeah.
Now, do your parents immediately go to the Hall of Fame for that?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I said, do your parents immediately go to the Hall of Fame for that?
Yes, they should. They should. My parents, yes, yes. My mother was very religious. She wanted to be a mother superior with the Roman Catholic Church. And listen, I want to make a statement. Have you ever heard the expression, the devil is in the details?
Sure.
Okay. But anyway, Frank, you mentioned some person's names, but the point is, I think that I think people are waking up about the trafficking as such. It's inhumane. It causes all types of disease and mental disease. And these girls cannot continue this for but so long, okay? And it's not good for them. They're children, okay?
Agreed.
Okay. And you have great shows. Thank you, Frank.
Oh, thank you, Patrice. Is that
okay?
I thought you were going to add something else there, but no, I agreed. No, nobody questions the problem. The question is, what's the solution? Is the solution to move in a Nevadan direction and decriminalize it, legalize it, regulate it, tax it, so that these sex workers can have the same protections that a bus driver might? Or is the solution to make the penalty so severe that you don't even think of going to a prostitute, as Texas is doing? What say you? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Pedro is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello there, Pedro.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
Yeah, as a retired cop of 30 years, I was one of the guys that helped clean up Times Square. I worked at Elmhurst, Queens area for prostitution. And I always felt bad for these kids. It's like, come on. You know, I know what I have to do with my job.
The kids being the Johns or the Carl girls?
No, the girls.
The girls.
The girls, yeah. Yeah. No. The Johns is that's something different. I personally feel they were just abusive.
It sounds like you think maybe the solution is not what Texas is doing, it's what Nevada has done.
I just kind of caught this right now because I just woke up a little while ago.
But, all right, well, that's fair enough. So what should the solution be on the subject of prostitution, Pedro? Is it stiffer penalties or is it legalization?
Stiffer regulation. You know, you got to look out for these girls. I mean, you know, I remember so many cases where, you know, I was involved in undercover work, and these were pimply kids. And why should they be involved in this?
Of course they should. Of course. No, I mean, absolutely not. Thank you, Pedro. Just like when gambling was illegal, you saw 14-year-old kids running numbers for gangsters. When something is illegal, there's no regulation. But with gambling being legal, you can't gamble if you're a 17-year-old. You can't work in a casino if you're a 19-year-old. There are strict regulations. And that's how it would be, ideally, if prostitution were legal. 800-848-WABC, your thoughts on what Texas is doing. I'd love to hear it. Any other subject is fair game as well. 1-800-848-9222. Russell is in White Plains. Hello, Russell.
Hey, Frank, could you please say tougher penalties rather than stiffer penalties?
I will say stiffer penalties.
Well, you sound like the Drek on the weekend, and it's very upsetting to me. But I'd like to comment, the problem with the prostitution thing is that if it's legal, the birth rate will plummet, and we'll have a lot of trouble replacing our population. That's what I think is really going on with making it illegal. And I think John Solomon said that the felonies would apply only to the Johns. And, of course, that would be plea bargain down. It'll be a boondoggle for lawyers. But I'd like to talk about Britney Spears as a person at risk, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Russell. Yeah, it's your time.
Well, she's a celebrity. And, you know, I feel uncomfortable even discussing it because it's her private medical legal decisions. It's a private thing. You know, when you had that piece on, she sounded dysfunctional to me. But you said, well, if she can make money, then she should make all her own decisions. Well, but that's where celebrities have been taken advantage of for a long time by managers. These people who are handling her affairs, they have a fiduciary duty. And what I think is that there's intrusive people who think they're in a position to judge. Like Norman. Like Norman's like, you couldn't understand because he wasn't talking about a conservatorship. He was talking about just a guy who depends on family money. And Norman's his trainer. I mean, what is a trainer? Is that like a drill sergeant?
I mean, he's somebody that observes somebody else that he's interacting with on a regular basis. I don't know the legal situation that his client was involved with there. Could have been a guardianship.
None.
Well, who knows? I mean, I can't.
The indolent rich. I mean, Norman's ungrateful. He's making a living off of this guy. I mean, Norman reads open letters on the weekend. At least he wouldn't try that with you. That's radio death, so I appreciate you keeping a handle on him. But, I mean, he's just sitting there commenting on somebody that he's making money off, and everyone else is doing the same with Britney Spears. Who are we? I'm in no position. She shaved her head. She's taking lithium. I mean, it's her business. Why are
exactly.
we in her business?
It's her business, which is why she should be freed. But that case is getting attention because she's a celebrity. There's a lot of other people that are in abusive guardianship relationships that you never hear about and will never hear about because they're obscure, maybe because they have no family. And those are the people that I want to speak up for and at least provide a platform for. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Phil is in Sparta. Hello there, Phil.
Hey, Frank. Good morning. I just want to comment on the Texas felony penalty law that's taking effect there. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's not about trafficking of these young girls at all. It's about the conservative politicians in Texas who just want to push their agenda. I think that the prostitution should be legal. So just another example where the quiet Democrats who are somewhat more liberal are pushed again into a direction that will look stupid if we don't want to stop trafficking. But the reality is prostitution should be legal, and they should stop making any laws in Texas.
Well, look, Phil, that's where I kind of come down without the political, you know, motivations that you've ascribed to the people involved. On the policy level, I'm with you. I mean, I do think prostitution should be legal. I've never patronized a prostitute, but I have many friends who have patronized prostitutes. I have friends that have been madams. I know people that have been sex workers themselves. And these are not aliens. These are, in some cases, very intelligent men and women that know exactly what they're getting into and want to engage in this kind of conduct. My view is, why shouldn't they be able to? I don't engage in that. That's my choice. Why shouldn't you have the choice to do something else? 800-848-WABC. I don't like what Texas is doing. I think that the goal of stopping sex trafficking is a laudable goal. Of course we should stop sex trafficking. Is this the best way to do it? I don't know. 800-848-9222. Leo is in Manhattan. Hello, Leo.
How are you doing?
I just wanted to say, thank you.
I came 30 years ago from Germany here, and back then in the days, every little bit bigger city have a government-run bordello, if you would say, where there was rooms. The girls was renting the rooms. They was paying insurance. They was paying taxes. They was moving from city to city. They stay sometimes 3 months, sometimes 5 months. And they have a doctor who was checking them 3 times a week so they would not spreading any diseases, et cetera, et cetera. This is for years and years in Germany legalized like that. So I think that's the way to go.
So it worked out well in Germany is what you're saying, Leo.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. For
the way we talk about to control it, to tax it, to have it under control, basically the age, et cetera, et cetera. That's how it works for a long time in Germany before I came in. And this is 30 years ago, so...
Yeah, Leo, I think that's the way to go. It makes sense to me. It sounds like it's worked out well over there. Although the way you said it, government-run bordellos rather than government-regulated bordellos. I picture single-payer bordellos, right? Government-socialized bordellos, the way you said that, which is I'm not sure exactly if that's how it's working in Germany. 800-848-9222. If you want to weigh in, you're welcome to. I will tell you... You know, if you're a sex worker and you get hurt, for instance, what protections do you really have? Not very many. You know, that's one of the reasons I think we need to go in another direction. Also, if you get hurt or you have some sort of chronic pain, Trinity Rehab is a great place for you to get some relief. Trinity Rehab will restore your freedom to live pain-free. This is a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art facility all over New Jersey. They have something called the EPAP machine, which is FDA-approved, non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing, gets rid of pain fast. If you have back pain, neck pain, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, knee pain, whatever the case may be, neck pain, you don't have to suffer anymore. You don't need an expensive surgery and a risky surgery. You don't need prescription pain medication, at least not yet. Try this. Try Trinity Rehab first before you turn to medication, before you turn to surgery. They have locations all over New Jersey. No prescription necessary. Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab at 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com. This is the original song that was written for the movie Spaceballs, a hit Mel Brooks, a Mel Brooks classic from 1987 that is one of my favorite movies. It always has been since the time it came out, and it remains one of my favorite films, a really, really terrific motion picture, a parody of things going on in the science fiction community. 800-848-WABC, talking about this Texas situation where they are making prostitution a felony. Your reaction. Mike, in Oak Ridge, New Jersey, what say you?
Frankie, I want to tell you something. All my best friends were prostitutes my entire life. And we've all remained, even though I don't see them anymore, we've remained friends through the years. I think it should be legalized. I mean, we're selling marijuana. And I just think they should allow it to be legalized. And
yeah,
I don't see anything wrong with it.
Well, look, you could see things wrong with it if you want, or you could not. But the question is, should it be illegal? I don't think anybody right now is being helped by the amount of police resources that's being spent on a sting at a massage parlor to catch Robert Kraft, an 80-something-year-old widower, getting a little bit of a happy ending from somebody that works in a massage parlor. I mean, who's really benefiting from that kind of law enforcement resources being spent on catching Robert Kraft?
I know. They're wasting their money on the law enforcement on this. It should just be legalized and tax it.
Yeah, that's where I am, Mike. I think you and I are on exactly the same page. Thank you. 800-848-9222. Charlie Finch calling in. Hello there, Charlie.
Remember the Shriners, Frank, that used to go around on those scooters at conventions in Atlantic City with the fezzes on their head with the tassels?
I do.
Keep it clean. Let's keep it clean for Molly.
Yes.
Now, Frank, lift every voice and sing. As every African-American knows, including my friend who calls in known as Peter, is a patriotic song. Whenever a listener who is black, like your prisoner listeners, hears Neil from Staten Island call it unpatriotic, or you respectfully and Lauren Conlon saying that you've never heard of it,
I didn't say I'd never heard of it.
One more thing, if I may. Two more things. Why is Ben Shapiro's voice still on the promos, of which there are way too many cats on ABC? And Mike Porcelli's meeting with your colleague, Greg Kelly, about bringing the Auto Lab to Saturday morning next week. Give Mike a call. Great show.
Thank you, Charlie. 800-848-9222. By the way,
We'll do the Ask Frank Anything portion of the show tomorrow at 1 a.m. if you want to tune in. That's where you get to ask me anything you want about anything. Radio stuff, politics stuff, stuff about books, movies, sports, whatever. But the thing that I have to stress when, you know, Charlie asks why are, and I think it was more of a rhetorical question, why are Ben Shapiro promos still on the station? I have no idea. I have no say in what goes on at the station. I have a little bit of influence over what happens on the 5.5 hours that I'm on the radio, but I'm not in management. I don't get to make decisions. I have no idea why certain promos are voiced by certain people. Save your breath is my advice. 800-848-9222. It's 1-800-848-WABC. Kevin is in New Jersey. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, Frank. Nice to talk to you. I do enjoy your show. I think you're really talented.
But thank you.
I have to disagree with you. I do a lot. I disagree with you a lot. But
that's okay. That's okay. That's fine. A lot of people disagree with me.
Yeah. But anyway, Texas law, I think it is a good law. I think people are going to lose their rights to own firearms. It's not just a felony. It just doesn't have to do with jail time. Has to do with rights, and they're gonna lose those rights once they get the felony. And I also think that the lady who called earlier said that the devil was in the details is exactly right. That you just seeing it in a perfect, like a picture. It's not gonna be that way. There's a lot of devastation that's gonna go along with prostitution. Young people are gonna get involved, just like. When I was young, I drank. It was illegal. I couldn't drink. Wasn't allowed to, but I did it anyway. Did drugs, so on and so forth. And I'm sure you did too when you were younger. But young girls are going to get involved and it's going to destroy families. Fathers are going to go out and cheat on their wives and it's just going to be devastating. We don't. And another thing is that women, you know, are just going to be reduced to a piece of scrap, you know, and it's, they're not going to have any ambition. They're going to make a lot of money, which is what a lot of people like to do, including me. But they're going to find an easy way to do it, and the society's going to suffer. I wish you guys would just think about that. And I wanted to call because it didn't seem like most of your callers are supporting it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you called, you know? Kevin, because I think you're speaking for a lot of people. Terms of and look, you make a lot of sense. But in terms of the premise that if prostitution is legalized, that more people will engage in it. Prostitution is very available in places that I've been, even where it's technically illegal, it's functionally legal. And mm-hmm. I've never been with a prostitute because, you know, it's not my thing. But I don't really know anybody that says I would use the services of a prostitute if only they'd make it legal. So do you really think there are a lot of men or women, for that matter, out there who would patronize a prostitute if it was legal but are not currently patronizing a prostitute?
Yes, I do. And it wouldn't necessarily happen right away. But as time went on and it became more, you know, people sat at their dinner table and talked about their neighbor who, hey, so-and-so just became a prostitute. You know, they're making great money. They just bought a new house. And the society is just going to go downhill. We just, you know, people, like you said, people have always patronized prostitutes. They have to go to the red light district. They have to go they take chances. They have, you know, there's risk involved. Just like with marijuana, you know, it's the same thing. If young people, I have seven children. And now I have a lot of grandchildren also, and I'd hate to see them getting high and see them stoned. It's just not right. We need to have, you know.
Well, so do I, Kevin, right? And look, thank you for the call. I don't think just because marijuana is I don't like marijuana. I hate the smell. I walk down the streets when I was in Las Vegas where it's legal. Every street you go down reeks of marijuana. It smells like a dying skunk to me. I hate it. Now, even before it was legal in New York, when the enforcement got a little bit lax, you walk down the streets of Manhattan, it's a horrible experience. Every street smells like a rotting corpse. And I don't like it. I almost feel like it's more of an attack on my quality of life to have recreational marijuana out there than prostitution. That being said, just because marijuana is legal, it doesn't mean your 13-year-old is going to go out and get high. It's still illegal for him. As a minor, it's still illegal. But that is a fair point. I'm glad Kevin called because, as I said, I think he's speaking for a lot of folks. You know what I'd like to do ideally? And I've been a big crusader for political reform for a long time. And one of the reforms that I have always been a big believer in, and former U.S. Senator Mike Gravel, who we just lost, was a big believer in it as well, is initiative and referendum. I would love to put a referendum on the ballot in New York State and in Texas and give people a choice. Let them vote. Should prostitution be legalized? Yes or no? And I think the people that you would see turn out for that election on both sides of the question are people that would never think of voting in any election ever. And I think that's what we want out of the political process. Unfortunately, in New York, your state legislature doesn't think you deserve that right, and they have continued to deny it to you. I wish we did have that right to choose. 800-848-9222. I am a big fan of professional wrestling, classic professional wrestling. I haven't watched it on a regular basis for many years, but I still read books about it. I still think about it. I still research wrestlers that I was always fond of, primarily wrestlers that wrestled in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So I've always been a fan of that era. I keep saying that I want to start following it again, but really, I have so little time to watch television that if I end up being home, I'll watch something that my wife wants to watch by and large, and I don't end up keeping up with the modern wrestling. But anyway, one of the greatest wrestlers who has ever lived is a fellow by the name of Terry Funk. His father was a wrestler. His brother was a wrestler. They would wrestle together. And he was a fine wrestler, not only for his wrestling abilities, but for his abilities on a mic. For instance, this is a promo that he cut, a little bit of, I'm not going to play the whole thing. This is a portion of a promo that he cut when he was wrestling with Florida Championship Wrestling.
I'm sure, being the wrestling fans that you are well aware of the NWA, the largest wrestling conglomerate in wrestling today, with over 220 syndicated stations. And I'm sure you're also familiar with the AWA and the WWF. These are all multi-million dollar organizations. But yet, there is a new one on the sunrise in Florida, and you know what that organization is. That is the FFNF. Funk and Florida. Believe me, the Funk brothers have come to Florida, and now we don't have millions of dollars. We don't have money to throw around. We don't have 220 syndicated stations. But what are we? We are individuals, and we are the best athletes in professional wrestling today.
And he goes on, and he's just so compelling and so great. And he was a tremendous wrestler, and he reinvented himself so many times. He was a great singles wrestler, but also a great tag team wrestler. He was a classic wrestler, great technical wrestler. He was the NWA world champion at a time when it meant something to be the world champion. Now they change titles every week. The titles are meaningless. But he had these great matches with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and with Ric Flair. And he was just a classic technical wrestler. Then, and by the way, most wrestlers are lucky if they have a 5-year career where they're stars. Terry Funk was a star for half century. He was a wrestler for 50 years. Then, in the 90s, he becomes a pioneer
in a new form of wrestling called hardcore wrestling, which is very violent and very different from the kind of wrestling that he'd been doing for 30 years. Now, what does that mean, hardcore wrestling? Well, instead of body slams and wrist locks and headlocks and suplexes and clotheslines and Irish whips, instead, you're dealing with chairs to the head. You're dealing with barbed wire. You're dealing with being body slammed through tables. You're dealing with, in some cases, explosions in the ring. I mean, very violent stuff. No way to fake any of this stuff. Getting hit in the head with a chair, it's very difficult to fake. So he becomes a pioneer as an older man in this totally new style of wrestling called hardcore wrestling. And the guy was a legitimate tough guy, probably one of the toughest men on the planet. And in 1999, there was a wrestling documentary came out, still worth seeing. It was called Beyond the Mat. And it follows Terry Funk going to his doctor, getting his knees examined because he was having some pain in his knees. Listen to what his doctor tells him, and then what the narrator of the documentary says, and then what his wife at the time says. This is from the 1999 documentary, Beyond the Mat.
On your good knee, your left knee, you have moderate to severe degenerative arthritis. You don't have a good joint space in here. You have some narrowing of the space, arthritic spicules in there, and it's not going to function very well. It ought to be able to get by the rest of your life just hurting all the time. All right? On your bad knee, on the right knee, you have no joint space. You have severe degenerative arthritis. You have worn that knee out. It's been hurt too many times, and you are going to need a new knee. You need a new knee now.
Let me ask you one thing. If I don't have an operation or if I don't have a new knee put in there, can I go ahead and live comfortably? Can I get around comfortably?
You shouldn't be able to get around comfortably now. This ought to give you pain chronically. It ought to be disabling to you. And that is a problem. There's not a whole lot we can do when we get to that point. And chronic pain for the next 30 or 40 years isn't a real fun thing to think about.
Terry wasn't happy with his doctor's prognosis. He told me he wasn't about to retire. In fact, he had agreed to fight in Philadelphia for ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling, a renegade company that Terry had pledged to get off the ground.
We've got a few ships over there.
Neither his doctor nor his family were thrilled about Terry's bout in Philadelphia. But Terry kept his promise.
Yeah, I'm a pack of show starts at.
I honestly think that my husband's fearless, and that's truth. I just don't think he's afraid of anything.
Okay, don't forget the Brandon Iron is in the trunk, right?
Yeah, I love you.
I wanted him to stop wrestling since probably 1990. I've decided that it's his profession, and it's up to him.
That was Terry Funk's wife. She passed away, unfortunately, about 2 years ago. But so think of what happened there. Terry Funk's doctor says, you need a knee replacement. I don't know how you're walking around now. You shouldn't be able to walk around. Not only does he keep going without getting the knee surgery for years, he doesn't retire. He keeps wrestling and doing this hardcore wrestling for years. The guy wrestled for another 15 years after that. After the doctor tells him, you shouldn't be able to walk, he keeps wrestling. Hardcore wrestling. So anyway, the point is, the guy was a remarkable performer, an incredible athlete, and as tough as they come. Probably not smart to do that, by the way. Once your doctor tells you, you shouldn't be able to walk, you need knee replacement, probably unwise to keep wrestling. So anyway, as tough as they come. And somebody who just in a profession that's filled with vipers and in a profession that's filled with backstabbers, not a single wrestling promoter has ever said a negative word about Terry Funk. And that is very rare in the world of professional wrestling. And this week, just a day or two ago, the news came out that at 77 years old, Terry Funk, and I linked to the article on my Facebook page. You can read it, facebook.com/MoranoFan. Terry Funk is now living in an assisted living facility where he's suffering from dementia.
Now, I'm not terribly surprised given the punishment that he's put his body through for the last half century, but it seems now that he's losing his mind that it seems as appropriate a time as any to remember the sacrifice that he put himself through, his body through, for the sake of our entertainment. Now, we can debate the ethics of that. We can debate the wisdom of that. But you can't debate the guy's toughness and the fact that a guy that everyone says is a pretty decent fellow is now suffering. And there's been a tremendous outpouring of support from the wrestling community on this. And Ric Flair, who's my favorite wrestler, who had a lot of legendary battles with Terry Funk, put out a statement saying how Terry Funk just never quit and is a guy that never stopped fighting. And hopefully he's still got some fight left in him. So best of luck to Terry Funk, to his daughters, to all of his friends, to his family. And I was certainly sad to see that news of his dementia. But you could read the article for yourself on my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan. If you want to join our Facebook group and contribute to some of the conversations that are being had about this show, I would encourage you to join it. Just go on Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. And it's a fun Facebook group. Sometimes people get a little out of line, but you got to roll with the punches. It's my advice. Morano Radio Fans and Haters. All right. I do want to encourage you, if you go to Morano Radio Fans and Haters, one of the things you'll see is a milk jug with Mr. T's picture on it. And Mr. T's saying in the milk jug, in the caption, "I pity the fool who doesn't drink Life Change tea." That's because one of our great listeners, Kevin McKay, is doing his best to document how his life is changing with Life Change tea. Now, he is not a celebrity, so it's not a celebrity endorsement. So he's chronicling exactly what he's been doing. So if you are interested in doing that, in seeing his progress, just go to Morano Radio Fans and Haters and see him. But now, what is Life Change tea? Life Change tea is an herbal proprietary formula that gives you more energy without caffeine. It tastes great. There are no fillers, no GMOs. It is 100% organic. It's a mild cleanse, a daily detox that cleanses you from the inside out. Their slogan is "The tea that makes you go." You can read the testimonials for yourself at getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you use the promo code Frank when you order, you will get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. Tell you what we're doing next. 15 seconds of fame. You can be heard on any subject for 15 seconds. You have a question, you have a joke, you have a story, you have a business that you want to put in a plug for, whatever you want to say, 15 seconds of fame next. 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. I got the rocking pneumonia, I need a shot of rhythm and blues.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We would also ask that you follow me on Twitter, at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. As I pointed out before, the one thing that seems to be very important these days in radio and television and politics, in academia, in every form of society, is a large social media following. So the more of you follow me on Twitter, the more juice I'll have along the, you know, within the radio world, for instance. So you can follow me on Twitter at Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. But for now, it is your time to be heard for 15 seconds at 800-848-9222 because it's time for...
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Ross is in White Plains. Hello.
Frank, is Nancy Sliwa still running against the entrenched Democrat Gail Brewer, whose chief accomplishment is wasting time at meetings?
Yes.
Good.
Okay, 800-848-9222. Raji is in New York.
Stop, stop, stop with the blatant lies, some of you hosts. Even on this station, President Obama never gave Iran any money. It was a tiny portion of the Iranian people's trillions of dollars in assets frozen by the U.S. and other governments.
Thank you, Raji. Mike in West Palm, hello.
What's up, Frank? Proud father-to-be. I'll make it quick, obviously. You know what? There's that guy again, I was going to say, from White Plains. You know what, my man? You throw verbal darts, you're self-absorbed, you're narcissistic, and you're a whiner. And I do call Frank Russo's show on the weekend. And you know what, dude? You should get your own show on the internet. Okay, you'll have an audience of three.
Thank you, Mike. 1-800-848-9222. Frankie in Glendale. Hello.
Good morning. Welcome back, Frank. Charlie Finch took the wind out of my sails. You know, John Cassimatidis has did a great job with WABC, and I think they need a quality program like the Auto Lab on Saturday mornings on ABC Radio.
You'll get no argument from me there. 800-848-9222. Rob is in New Jersey. Hello.
Yeah. Frank, I think the ones who shot, killed, assassinated the Haitian president can't aim straight. It should have been them, directed at Putin. That Putin's a lowlife. We should try.
Thank you, Rob. 800-848-WABC. Peter's in Queens. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to make a statement. When you touched me with that dementia, because my wife has dementia, but she went into a health facility, and now I lost her because there was a health proxy against my wife. And now I lost my wife because the health proxy supersedes being a husband.
Oh.
And I wish to warn everybody about being very careful about...
You know, Peter, I wish you would have called at 3 o'clock so we'd had some more time to talk about this. Call me tomorrow. I feel terrible for your situation. I'd love to go into this a little bit more, but I can't do it justice in 15 seconds. Neil in Staten Island, hello.
The Online Post had an article tonight that 4 million people are dead from COVID-19. When is the White House going to go after these communist lowlifes and get some reparations to the United States and the world?
E. Frank in Astoria, hello.
Yes, I noticed that the civilian former president, Donald J. Trump, left the government closed on January 20th. I wonder why the present president, Joe Biden, doesn't sue President Trump for doing that.
800-848-9222. The Irishman in the Bronx.
Read the Dream Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. The Dream Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. Gene Pierre is a criminal and a fraud and sent an innocent New York City cop to prison.
Thank you, Irishman. Fred in Yonkers, hello.
Hey, Frank. Great story about the wrestler named Funk. You know, my namesake, Fred Funk, is the golfer. And my friend Alan B. Combs was very funky. We want the Flory Dories. We want the Flory Dories.
Thank you, Fred. You have 3 seconds left there. 800-848-9222. Jerry in Freeport. Hello.
Tis a moron.
800-848-WABC. Anthony in Edison. Hello.
Yes, good morning. People tend to forget that, you know, slavery has been over for 155 years now. It's not like it ended yesterday. BLM is a scam organization, stirring up trouble with the Democrats, not creating any good for anyone. And Blue Lives Matter more than All Lives Matter in the end.
Thank you, Anthony. Why don't we end it on that note? By the way, you are going to want to listen to the next 90 minutes because Juliette Huddy and I are going to bring you the news.
And we've got traffic, we've got business, we've got weather, you name it. Weather's been awfully funky. Speaking of Terry Funk, the weather's been awfully funky, and we'll tell you exactly what you can expect in that regard today. It was a thunderstorm warning until 11 p.m. last night, but then the thunderstorm never came. There's still some real problems with flooding all over the area, so we'll bring you the latest on all that. If you want to stay in touch with me, you can email me at frank.morano@wabcradio.com. I do look at all your email. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. The snail mail, which is, you know, just the regular conventional mail, takes a little longer to get to me, and it takes me a little longer to respond, but I generally respond to email right away. So if you have an email machine, that is generally the best way of getting in touch with me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. But if you do want to send a letter, I'll certainly read it. Send it to P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York, 10163. Just send it to my attention, P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York, 10163. All right, that slams the lid on things for today. If you have questions about anything, we'll do Ask Frank Anything at 1 a.m. tomorrow. In the meantime, to be continued.